comedy, stand-up comedians. A show opened last night at Fringe After Dark. And at 10:30, Toto Komatsubara and Zach Washington are Buskers on the Road. And their show opens today as well. They've got a show at 12. Get back. Play this back. Welcome back to Fringe Radio. I'm Damien. I'm going to be with you from 9 till 12. and guest-wise this morning, we've got some guests coming in. First one is not until 10. So to start off with, I'm going to play back the interview and the songs that Maggie Coco played yesterday. Her show, Maggie Coco's Science for Sociopaths, opens today at the Octagon Theatre at 6:30 p.m. And there's another show tomorrow at 8 p.m. So Maggie came in yesterday and played three beautiful songs from this show that she's put together, a song cycle, and I'm going to play that back for the first perhaps half an hour of the show to help promote the show and for you to get a taste of what it's like and what it's all about. And it's certainly one of those shows that, having talked to the performer and the creator, made me definitely want to see it. So here goes. Born Under Punches, brackets, The Heat Goes On, by Talking Heads. Very distinctively by Talking Heads. And Maggie was singing along, and I was like, do you know the name of the song? She's like, no. And I was like, well, how could you be singing along then? You just know it.
Yeah, it's probably just in the ear.
Yeah. Okay, great. Well, welcome to Fringe Radio, Maggie. And you're here ahead of your two shows at the Octagon Theatre, one on the 13th of October, this Thursday at 6:30 p.m., and one on Friday the 14th at 8 p.m. Do you like the Octagon as a venue for your show?
I do. It's so every show is different because there's audience participation, and so the different venue necessitates we adapt to the venue,
right,
basically. So,
so does audience participation involve them coming up on stage with you, or
it depends? Yeah. So it's literally always different. So I play. I have a song cycle that I've composed between 10 and 12 songs that tells a narrative. So this is the premiere of the second song cycle.
So what's the definition of a song cycle?
So a song cycle is a sequence of songs that together tell a singular narrative.
So would that Put Up and Shut Up have been an example of a song cycle?
Possibly.
Oh, you didn't see that?
I didn't see that
one. Okay, so it was a performance of some songs from an upcoming musical telling a story of a woman who went through forced adoption, who had was subjected to forced adoption.
Yes, could be okay. A song, could be considered a song cycle.
Right.
Mine is adapted, is adapted from the, I suppose you would call it the classical music sense, because I studied opera and I studied song cycle,
right,
which is a type of song that was written for opera singers to sing in their off-season kind of thing originally, and then it became its own thing. But it's got a particular, like, the relationships between the keys between the songs, and there's motif that carries on throughout the cycle and things like that. So
musical motifs.
So I would say that you could consider what they did a song cycle, and this is that to a slightly more specific degree.
and in terms of, so musical was the genre that they were operating in, so I guess what was your genre in musical terms?
Right. So I would say that mine is theatrical pop ballads.
Right. There's probably a playlist on Spotify called exactly that.
Yeah.
Because there's a playlist for everything. So you say it's different every time. So every performance is, the song cycle is essentially the same. The songs are written,
yeah, but they're kind of bones. So I know what the melody is going to be, more or less. I know what the chord structure is going to be, more or less, and what the themes are and things like that. But I play it differently every time because I'm trying to account for the emotion that the audience is giving me, and also the emotion that the artist is bringing to the song cycle.
Right. Wow. So how do you gauge, or how does that register with you, the audience emotion? Is it to the kind of the verbal feedback they're giving you, or?
It can be. It's often, though, more an unspoken kind of an energy that you're reading in the room.
Right.
Yeah.
So what happens if that energy is quite low or quite flat. Like, how do you acknowledge that with the audience, or do you just work with it as is? Or?
Well, your typical music performance, which is, you know, what I come from, is more typical, is with you sort of generate the energy and then get the audience into it, and then there's back and forth. So there's that element of it in the same way.
Right. Okay. So this piece of work has been around for a while, because I've seen the you know Science for Sociopaths is the name of the song cycle.
So that's the name of the project. So there's different song cycles. So the last song cycle was called Like a Moth. And one was the one that we toured for. We premiered it at the first Fungare Fringe, and then toured it around, did really well with that. And then this is the premiere of the second song cycle. So Science for Sociopaths is the project. And then it's a little bit different from your typical music project in that there's the name of the project, and then there's the name of the song cycle. You can almost think of it as the name of the album kind of thing.
I see. So what's the name of this song cycle or album?
I don't know yet.
Oh.
It hasn't told me.
Right. So what was the first one called? Sorry.
The first one was called Like a Moth.
Like a Moth. Okay. And was that somehow kind of telling us something about the...
Yeah, it just came up in conversation with a friend as I was talking. We were talking about what the song cycle was about. So the first song cycle was about a relationship that doesn't work out, but it takes you from the onset of the relationship all the way to the breakup and through a little bit of the aftermath, and talks about, it's from a first person perspective, but it's what you learn about yourself through that.
So like a moth to a flame, was that
yes.
the kind of right? Okay, so what's the narrative in this song cycle? Are you allowed to tell us, or
it
to be surprised?
Happy to. So this new song cycle is about interpersonal and systemic abuse and resilience. So it takes a character from birth through young adulthood.
Right. So say that one more time. It's about
interpersonal and systemic abuse and resilience.
Right.
So the character experiences. It's not about. Well, it could be. It could be about the kinds of abuse that is prosecutable. You know, like being physically beaten and stuff like that. But it's more about the things that everybody experiences, but we don't really have ways to hold people accountable for yet.
Right.
We have buzzwords for them, like gaslighting and things like that. It's a lot about that kind of stuff.
Right.
And sort of shining a light on how that manifests in everyday relationships, parent-child relationships, romantic relationships, friendships, things like that.
So in terms of prosecutable, it's possible that it would never be possible to prosecute that, but awareness is the key. It's
like, absolutely, yeah.
So that people won't let those things be done to them.
Yes.
Perhaps.
Yeah. Okay. Or it's about the cycles, you know, because like people who are born and raised into those things, it's not about blaming your parents necessarily. It's about recognizing, you know, what you've inherited and sort of getting beyond that so that those cycles don't continue.
Mm. Okay. Well, you brought a guitar in, so it'd be good. Perhaps a good moment to have a song.
Cool.
What are you going to do for us?
Okay. So I'm going to do a song called Mother Dearest. Oh, I'd like to point out that this song cycle is on piano, not guitar. I'm doing guitar specifically for this.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay.
So if my
so you'll be playing in the show, you'll be playing piano.
Piano, right? Oh. So just so you know, I try not to do disclaimers, but this is a disclaimer because I've only played on guitar today.
Your preference is to play piano.
Yes.
Why is that? Just before you, like, what is it about piano that?
Well, I'm a vocalist by trade, and so I approach instruments very much from a music theory perspective, from a music theory background. So I don't speak instrument particularly fluidly, and piano is just much easier to see, theory wise, what it is that I'm trying to accomplish.
Right. So, and on stage, is it just you and the piano, or
it's me and the piano, and then the artist that I'm working with,
okay.
Which I'll tell you more about in a second. Yeah.
Great. So this one's called Mother Dearest.
Mm. Were you too young? Were you too old? Were you too broken, beaten, blue, or just naive? Were Was it too much or not enough? Did you lose every piece of your identity? Then there was me. I don't wanna break your heart tonight. I don't wanna have this same old fight. But I'll never make the same mistakes you made. Can you tell me truly wherein lies the is it all right now that I'm grown? Have you found something in this world that gives you peace? Can you forgive me for asking? But I'm hoping that we can both find some relief. Just maybe we can start to heal your heart tonight. We don't need to have this same old fight. Mama, I'll never make the same mistakes you made. Can you learn to live, to let go of the shame? Just naive.
Thank you. Wow, that was beautiful. So that's Mother Dearest, and whereabouts in the cycle does that appear? Which part of the show is that?
I believe it's number 8 out of 11.
Right. Mm. Is that reasonably fixed? Like the order that you play the songs in?
Yeah.
Okay.
I probably won't change that up because I do let the artists that I'm working with know ahead of time kind of what the sequence of events is, roughly. Okay. Yeah.
So how did the concept or the idea for the show being about interpersonal and systemic abuse, is that what sort of was the starting point for you, or did you write the songs and then the theme came out of that, or?
I wrote about half the songs and then the theme came out of that. This one also follows from the first song cycle, so I had a back catalog of albums and singles and just unreleased, unrecorded songs. And the first Fringe was the first opportunity that I had to perform coming out of lockdown, but I didn't feel like my music was particularly fringy, so
interesting. Yeah,
so in order to sort of open myself up from beyond the typical music performance, what I've done, I was new to New Zealand at the time. I only got here 3 weeks before lockdown.
Wow.
The first one.
Mm.
And I reached out to Fringe. Well, I, you know, registered and I reached out to Fringe and I was like, hey, can you connect me with any visual artists who would be interested in collabing? And I thought, that'll be it. I'll play my songs and then someone else will do their thing and that'll be the thing. And then as I was deciding which songs to do, I was seeing these themes and I was like, ooh, I could do a song cycle because I loved studying song cycles in school. And so then I pulled these songs up and I was reorganizing them and developing them and doing what my mom affectionately calls mental masturbating, which I adore. So I had a really good time doing that. And then I was doing the first show at Wham. Mm. And they had this huge interactive sculpture there that was by Kim Groenewald and Trent Morgan. Mm. And so that was the room that we were going to be performing in. And I was like, ooh, we should make use of this. So worked with, my first show was with a couple of dancers. And what we worked out was because they were dancing in front of this ginormous sculpture, we just gave the audience an opportunity to manipulate the sculpture in between songs and basically change the background of what was happening, but invited them to really think about it and be creative about it and be like, how are you feeling right now? And see if you can't, through the sculpture, kind of be a part of the show. And so we filmed it and we took pictures throughout and you could see the development of it and how the piece was sort of coming apart. And then at the end, how it kind of came back together.
So they were quite sort of receptive to that. They were quite, they kind of knew what to do.
It was stunning. I mean, yeah? there's no right or wrong way to do it, which is the beautiful thing about this. And again, one of the reasons that it turns out different every time, because the venue's different, the collaborating artist is different. So at this point, I've done this with painters and dancers and light projection specialists and physical theater practitioners, and it's always very, very different. So it's my lens, but then it's filtered through the collaborating artist lens, and then the audience gets an opportunity to demonstrate how things have been filtered through their lens, and we're creating a cumulative awareness and a cumulative discussion.
So tell us a bit about the artists that you're working with for these two shows then.
Yes. So I'm working with Josh Kiwi Kiwi on Thursday. And Josh is a very exciting self-taught Whangarei-based artist who has just through his, I mean, incredible artworks, but also online presence and other skills, developed an international following. And so I'm very excited to be working with Josh. And Josh has never done anything like this before. Actually, most of the artists I work with have never done anything like this before.
It's quite an unusual concept, or quite an unusual kind of
confluence of things. They tend to be one-offs, so they're very cool in that way.
So what medium will he be working in? Like, what?
He'll be working with paints because we'll be in a closed setting. So if you're coming to the show, please don't wear anything that you care about. I love getting dressed up for an event. This is not that event.
So there'll be paint flying around.
Yeah, we try not to let it fly. You know, don't be scared, Octagon Theater.
Yeah, I was thinking of
try not to let it fly. No, we'll have tarps and everything and whatnot. But yeah, there will be paints.
So will it be you and Josh on stage together?
Yes, and the audience will be invited to at intervals of Josh's choosing to join him on stage to contribute to the painting.
Wow, it sounds like things could get out of hand, but like it depends on the audience sort of understanding. Do they need quite a lot of direction with that,
or so we do spend the first 5 to 10 minutes of the show like getting people into the headspace and assuring them that like you can't mess this up, there's no wrong or right here, other than the things that are always wrong or right,
Okay. So Josh is doing the artwork for the first show, and then have you got someone else for the second show?
I do. So, Olivia Garelja is supposed... Sorry, I just made a very assertive smack with my hand. Olivia Garelja is supposed to be doing the second show. She had COVID last week, and so we're waiting on a negative test. But she has a special guest who is going to be joining her if she's able to do it, and if she's not able to do it, who will be taking over for her. So you'll just have to come and see who that is.
And is that a completely different medium that...
No, that one's also going to be paint. Mm. Well, actually, it could be, depending on the person, be illustration.
Right.
So
is the idea that the art that's produced, is that sort of, is that ephemeral? Is it gone at the end of the show, or what do you do with the...
Oh, good question. So last year, I had the first Science for Sociopaths art exhibit at the Quarry Arts Center, which is something that I never thought that I'd be able to say, because I'm not a visual artist myself. But
the work that came out of the shows.
Eventually, we accumulated all these artworks, and we were like, what do we do with them? And we were like, I guess we put on a show. So we did an exhibition of artworks that were created at Science for Sociopaths shows, and I imagine we'll do the same.
You probably get asked this question all the time, but Science for Sociopaths, to me, is a bit of a misdirection. It's like, what's the kind of thinking behind that title?
Okay, so there's twofold, right? So the first is that I have a parent who's a sociopath. So it's a kind of a tongue-in-cheek, like, I was a science experiment for a sociopath. So there's that side of it, just dark, funny, haha for me.
And do the audience know this? Is that something you share with them?
If they look into it, they know. I write openly about these things. Mm-hmm. And the second side of that is that a sociopath is someone who does not experience empathy and emotions the way that your average person does. They're motivated by things like, and because of that, they're motivated by things like sex and power and money and things like that, which is what causes them to sometimes do things that are what the average person would consider immoral. But I'm not going to get into all of that right now. Science for Sociopaths. So how sociopaths get by in the day to day, because you can't just operate openly as if you lack those feelings, is they learn to mimic them.
Uh-huh.
At the right and when to do that. And so what is a better education in emotion than music? So Science for Sociopaths being a deep dive into these emotions is actually a perfect education.
And potentially a therapeutic experience for people? Is that your intention?
My intention, it's a therapeutic experience for me. And so my intention, the reason that I mean, people love music for different reasons, but I'm a very word thematic, emotionally motivated person. Mm. And so for me, one of the things that has drawn me to music and kept me in it is that therapeutic quality.
Great. All right, well, we better have another song. So you're going to play something else from this as-yet-unnamed song cycle?
Yes.
Great. Mm. What are you going to play?
This one's Curl... what is this one called? Little Girl Get Up? Yeah.
Okay, great.
What is this one called? I know these. All right, again, guitar. Two, three, four. And the world keeps turning. And the world keeps turning. And the world keeps turning, 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 turning. And the world keeps turning. And the world keeps turning. And the world keeps turning, 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 turning. Little girl, get up and find your center. Little girl, get up and make your way. We're moving on. Little girl, nobody's got the answers. Little girl, it's not you, it's not you. Everybody knows that you do what you have to do. Everybody knows might not look the same for me and you. You wish everything was fair. Well, it's not what you're fighting for. If not you, if not you, if not you, if not. Little girl, get up and find your center. Little girl, get up and make your way. We're moving on. Little girl, nobody's got. Little girl, it's not you, it's not you, it's not. Little girl, it's not you, it's not you, it's not. Little girl, it's not you, it's not.
devil's in the details, and when it shows, you never really know until you know. The devil's in the details, and when it shows, you never really know.
Maggie Cocco and Little Girl...
Little Girl, Get Up.
Get Up. And while you were singing that, I remember that I'd seen a photo of you on one of the Fringe, Whangarei Fringe Facebook posts.
Yes.
It's quite distinctively you in the white dress.
Thank you. A lot of people think it's the other one, so you got it right, yeah.
No, definitely not. Mm. So how old were you in that picture?
I don't know. How old do I look?
About... 3 or 4, maybe.
That sounds
how
right.
Come? How come that's there? I mean, what was the kind of context for that?
So the context for that is that I kind of wanted to drive home. So I put in the description that it's about interpersonal and systemic abuse and resilience, and so I wanted to drive home that these are things that happen to everybody, but particularly children.
Mm.
Yeah.
Right.
And okay. So, and me, it happened to me. So
right.
It's a picture of me.
Right. And looking at that picture now, what do you think? I mean, especially in the context of that song seemed to sort of be addressed to maybe a little girl like that.
Yeah. I think I've been several people over the course of my life already. And I feel like, you know, you never really know it until you know the devil's in the details. Mm. You know, like that little girl didn't know that what she was experiencing was abuse.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
Kind of, yeah.
And so I'm guessing music has been an important part of healing, would you say?
I'd say it's been the only consistent
right
in my life.
Right. And did that start at a very young age? Your...
Yeah, I've always been musical. I've always known I wanted to be a musician. Mm. Like my entire life I've been like, I'm going to be a musician when I grow up. And it's really cute when you're a kid and people are like, oh, that's so cute. And then you get older and people go, oh, no. I start to get worried.
Yeah. Well, what's your backup plan?
Right.
So you said earlier in the interview that, you know, you thought your music wasn't that fringy. And so you took it out on the road after that. Is that what you did?
I did.
Yeah. For the first song cycle. Is that the plan with this one?
That is the plan with this one. I really enjoyed the whole concept of experiencing my music through other people's filters and senses.
Mm.
And so I wanted to, it made it, it made me feel less alone, you know, and I know that the audience feedback that I got was that, you know, I thought I was the only one kind
right.
of
thing. So that's feedback you're getting after the show when people come up to you and talk
to
you?
Yeah. And it can be very emotional. Mm. So there is, I do issue trigger warnings. It can be very emotional, but it is, at the end of it, it's always quite hopeful. I like to, actually, this new show very much rails against ignoring reality at the expense of a comfortable lie, preferring a comfortable lie at the expense of reality.
Right.
Very much rails against that, because I think that's where a lot of people fall through the cracks.
In terms of people who've experienced abuse, the curtain of silence around it that tends to get, that couldn't have happened, or you're lying, or that kind of stuff. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, yeah, or just we don't talk about it.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
We're just not going to talk about it. You know,
what's it like for you if, I'm not saying triggered, but if this brings things up for people, are you then at the end of the show, you then some sort of, you know, do you have to receive that from them, or how do you deal with that? Because that could be quite heavy.
It can be quite heavy. Mm. My poor partner. I'm often absolutely depleted.
Yeah.
After a show.
Yeah.
But it's worth it.
So, really?
Yeah, it is.
It's sustainable for you as a performer to.
Oh, I can't do it every night.
Right. So what sort of, if you take it out on the road, where, what sort of venues, or what sort of, what sort of.
Definitely alternative venues. I don't really market this toward your typical music venues, and I still make my living as a musician, so I do all of that. You know, I do the cover bands, and I do the music that people want to hear in bars, and I do all of that. But this is something different. I don't even market it towards those venues. It's not something you can just throw at someone in a bar when they're going out playing right on the town.
they have to know what they're coming to.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So this is more theaters or alternative venues. I've had really good luck with various art scenes and art galleries, and reaching out and talking about the show and the art component.
Yeah.
And getting those crowds to come and experience things, and it's it hits home frequently, because a lot of people turn to art for self-care.
Sure. So you've been in New Zealand nearly 3 years.
Mm.
And I'm guessing that, and at some point this might be something you want to take out of New Zealand.
Yeah, I'd love to. When I can.
And would that be back to the States, or what would you like
I'd
to do?
I'd actually like to take it to Australia first. But I can't actually leave until I get my next visa, so I'm in a perpetually rolling over holiday working visa situation.
Right.
Which is cool, because it's cool in a sense. Well, it's cool that I'm able to stay.
Mm.
It's also cool that I've been put in a situation where I can't actually take permanent work, and so it's freed me up quite a bit to develop this project.
Right.
So that's been great. And then, of course, there's all the limitations that you can imagine that come with that. So I don't qualify for any funding from here or in the States for any of the work that I'm doing. So I do have a Patreon, which is people subscribe. All of my work is pay what you can.
Mm-hmm.
Performances, lessons, everything.
Including these two shows?
Including these two shows.
Right.
So I give a recommended amount based on what I need to make back to cover costs.
Sure.
But I don't want the people who would most benefit from any of my work to not be able to access it because of money.
Right.
I would have been that person at one point.
Sure. Who else is doing this kind of stuff? Are there other people out there, other artists doing this kind of thing? Like this, doing song cycles about these sorts of things? Or like, who are your kind of, I guess I'm asking, who are your influences, or who are your kind of, you know?
I don't know. There probably are tons of people doing this, like, or something very similar to it right now, but I don't know who they are.
Okay. Well, who are you listening to at the moment?
I actually, because of the nature of my, the way that I relate to music, I can become very emotional when I listen to music, so I don't, I have to be like my audiences. Like, I have to know that I'm going to listen to something.
Wow.
And listen to it. If I'm listening to music just for the sake of listening to music, it's going to be instrumental, and usually instrumental jazz.
Oh.
If it's vocal, I'll be focused too much. Yeah, I can't have anything on in the background or anything.
So if you're going to sit down and listen to something like that, which demands your full kind of, what would you?
Right now I'm listening to Shayna Lang. Shayna Grace. And she's a singer-songwriter from West Auckland who just moved to Whangarei. And I heard her for the first time at the Fringe Festival at What the Folk, and bought both of her CDs, and wow. they're phenomenal. Just very kind of similar to what I do in terms of the deep dive into the emotions and the, right. the thoughts and the feelings and the self-development, but a very different stylistically.
Shayna Grace. Mm-hmm. Name is right. She's recently moved to Whangarei.
Yeah, wow. She's local. Come see her.
Great. Is she performing on her own at the Fringe, or is she...
Yeah, she performed with What the Folk.
Yep.
At the beginning of the festival.
Right.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, well, we better wrap this up. We've got time for one more song, so have you got another one you can share with us?
I do. I'm going to do one that's was rejected from both song cycles so far. But it is...
On what basis?
On what basis? Just that it was just tangential enough from the storyline to not be necessary.
Right.
But I do love the song, and it is a sing-along, so if anybody anybody at home wants
okay.
to, yeah.
Cool. What's it called?
What is it called? The Illusion. Yeah, sorry, my brain.
Cool.
I'll sing you a song, we'll make a toast, send off the ones we love the most with the gentlest illusion. I couldn't aspire to more than this, I couldn't impart more than the bliss of a well-spun confusion. La, la, la.
Beautiful. That was Maggie Cocco with Illusion. Hopefully Mickey and I groaning along in the background didn't completely spoil it. That was great. I really enjoyed that. I was thinking while you were singing, for me, a performer that I love is someone who sings their heart out. Mm. And I feel like you really sing your heart out.
Thank you.
And yeah, it's emotional. It's very sort of, it's powerful. And you've got a beautiful voice. How would you describe, like, what, in sort of technical terms, what is your voice, musical terms?
I suppose technically I'm a lyric soprano, but right. So I did study classically, but I haven't done any of that. Basically, I graduated and was like, I'm gonna sing my own music, and I'm gonna sing in bars and stuff like that. And so I started singing in cover bands and doing like weddings and corporate events and casinos and stuff like that. And I got to travel all over the States and do a lot of really get into places. This is the thing about music, is I've been able to see places and meet people that I would never have the opportunity to otherwise. It's been really, really amazing. But in the process of doing that, I got away from myself a little bit. I became really focused on playing what other people wanted me to sing. And so this is been really good because it's been a return to me and the reason I got into music in the first place.
Great. And that's happened since you've been here in New Zealand?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Awesome. All right. Well, it's been great to have you in. Thanks for coming. The shows are at 6:30 p.m. tomorrow, Thursday the 13th of October, at the Octagon Theatre, and Friday the 14th of October, 8 p.m. Tickets are $30 or pay what you can. And it's a 1-hour show. And I hope having Maggie here has helped you get a sense of what the show's about. And there's a lot to it, really, actually, once you get into it. It's not just a gig. It's a lot more than that.
Yeah.
And the artists on Thursday night will be Josh Kiwi-Kiwi on stage with Maggie, and then on Friday, hopefully, Olivia Gorelja, who'll both be doing some painting. And there's more information on the Fringe Facebook page about the show, and you've also got your own website, have you got
a website, I'm on the social medias, I've got a Patreon, I got all the things.
Okay, you can't not find out what you need to know. Okay, great. Thanks for coming in. I'll put the playlist back on and be back in a little while. Thanks for welcome back to Fringe Radio. That was yesterday's interview with Maggie Cocco, or Cocco, I'm sure how to say it. Looks like Cocco to me, but anyway, that was yesterday's interview and some songs from the current show, the current song cycle. Okay, so quick look at what happened yesterday at the Fringe. The Happy Prince had two shows, and they've got another two shows today, one at 11 and one at 12. So I managed to catch the 2 p.m. show, and it's a cast of three, which is quite small for a Northern Youth Theatre cast, in my experience. And it's all nicely set up with cardboard. It's a cardboard set, so they've sort of made a cityscape out of cardboard boxes, and the performers move around that. And it's the Oscar Wilde story of the Happy Prince, which is a statue, and its relationship with the swallow. And you kind of always wonder with Oscar Wilde stuff, what was there a subtext going on there with his unhappy life? Well, latterly, I think unhappy. Interesting show. And at 2 p.m., the Open Virtual Studio happened yesterday, and we talked to Jared Taylor about that, and I would be interested to know if anyone participated in that. Send us an email, bark@beagleradio.co.nz. Tell us about your experience. The Imaginarium is ongoing throughout the Fringe. Starts at 3:33 p.m. every day, and runs until Sunday the 16th of October. Apart from Fringe Radio, it's the longest running event in Fringe. If Fringe Radio could be considered to be an event, I think it is. It's an event for me. I'm sitting here with my Danish pastries and hoping for a coffee at some point. Then Soy Boys opened last night at Fringe After Dark, and they'll be here this morning at 10:30, I think. They will be here at 11 o'clock. I'll be talking to Oren and Finn from the Soy Boys, stand-up comedians. Then at 6:30 p.m. last night, the final show of Like Sex, play by Nathan Joe. I was definitely at that, and it was great. We had a good, nearly full house, and everyone who came seemed to that I spoke to seemed to really enjoy it and find it moving and amusing and not confronting necessarily, but challenging, provocative maybe is the better word, piece of theatre. There are some bits where, you know, where you kind of want it to stop, but at the same time, what's happening is real or can be real, unfortunately. So that was great. And thank you so much to the cast of Alone, who very patiently dealt with us running over time. And that was really my fault for not actually finding out the running time of the play. I just took a punt on an hour, and it was all a bit of a rush registration. But anyway, that's history now. And Alone managed to get their show underway a bit later than advertised. But I guess that's the difficulty of having a half-hour changeover. It doesn't give you much time in case things do change. I've had some great reviews from people, friends who were at the show. Thanks for those. Keep them coming in. I've been forwarding them onto the cast and just letting them know how much people enjoyed it and how much they enjoyed their acting and their interpretation of the characters. There was a Morris Dancing workshop at 7 p.m. at Just Thrive, and apparently Misanthropy is unwell with COVID. Seems to be still COVID about, and so that's a shame. But she's apparently rescheduled her show. Not sure if I've got the right pronoun there, but maybe they have arranged to reschedule their show. I think it's for next Tuesday, but I'll try and find out for sure about that. And then Alone had a really good house last night, looked fairly full for their first show. And then at the same time, there was comedic lube wrestling, and we talked to Andy Sondolini, who's the I don't know what you'd call her, the perpetrator of comedic lube wrestling. And I had Caitlin Scott, who runs 116, she sent me a video of that, and it looked suitably deranged, I thought, debauched maybe a little bit, and certainly decadent. People throwing each other around in 200 litres of lube, and it's not the kind of lube that you buy, you know, in the pharmacy for human sexual activity. Apparently it's what they use for, you know, internal examinations of cows and horses, but apparently it's food safe. You can eat it. It doesn't, you know, it's fairly, what's the word? Benign. Anyway, comedic lube wrestling, that is so fringe. And apparently that's the first time it's been done. And apparently there were also jokes. You know, the comedic bit was there was actually some comedy performed. So what a day. What a day it was. Okay, I'm going to carry on with some music. And as you may know, if you listen to the show, I'm going through a bit of a Baroque pop phase. And leading the charge is Rufus Wainwright. And here's a great track by him called Damsel in Distress.
Behind the square of snow.
Damsel in Distress by Rufus Wainwright. Okay, so let's have a look at what's on today. So we've got The Happy Prince at 11. And then here at 116 at 12 is Barrier Ninja, which is a one-person show by Julie Edwards. And it's a verbatim show about Hauora. So it's about the experiences of Tangata Whaiora, and which is Māori for patients, I guess, what we would call patients, and also people working in the health system, the health sector. Barrier Ninja examines the experiences of health through the perspectives of 9 different people. So Julie plays those 9 different people, and the verbatim technique that she uses is to have the person's audio of the person speaking from the interview playing in one of her ears while she performs on stage. And I think that must be quite a difficult thing to do, or perhaps something you get used to. But the play has been seen by more than 400 medical students, so it's a sort of educational piece in a sense for medical students, but also verbatim seems to be a great way for particularly marginalized or normally unheard voices to be put on stage. There was a show earlier a couple of months ago called The Keyser in the Margarine about dementia. And one of the more famous verbatim plays is The Vagina Monologues, which is a different style of verbatim. The style of verbatim that Julie and the Keys in the Margarine crew use is to minimize interpretation on the part of the actor. They just they try to replicate as faithfully as possible the gestures, mannerisms, intonation, and general sort of physicality of the person they're playing. And when you watch it, when I watched The Keyser and the Margarine, knowing that, I could really appreciate how faithfully that was being done. And it's a sense of sort of honouring the person and their story, and not allowing an actor's natural inclination to to interpret and embellish, to be, to avoid that if possible. So that's at 12 o'clock at 116. There's another show tomorrow at actually there's two shows at 116 today. Sorry, there's one at midday and one at 6 p.m. and then a further show at 5:30 p.m. tomorrow, also at 116. Okay, and then also so Barry Ninjas on at 12. Also at 12, the Buskers on the Road are performing their first show, and I'm hoping to talk to them this morning. Oh, sorry, tonight. No, I've got that wrong. That might be a mistake in the program. It says that they're performing at 12, and then when you go to their page in the program, it's oh no, I'm looking at the wrong thing. They've got two shows. There's the Buskers on the Road, and then there's the Buskers on the Road Comedy Cabaret. Right. I hadn't realized. So the Buskers on the Road show is today at midday, from midday to 4 p.m., and it's Koha or free. It's a four-hour show in the Cameron Street Mall, a street entertainment spectacular of circus juggling, magic, comedy, and acrobatics. Fun for the whole family. The performers are from Zactacular. Oh, sorry, the performers' names are Zactacular, who is from New Zealand and Germany, and Kozo Chaos, who's from New Zealand and Japan, and also featuring local guests act. I really need a coffee. Local guest acts. It's free to attend, but bring some cash to show support. That's a nice way of asking for a koha. It's free, but bring some cash to show support. Well, as it should be, these people need to earn a living. Throw money at them. Well, gently. Okay, and then at 2 p.m., so that's at 12 in the Cameron Street Mall. 2 p.m., the Happy Prince has, I believe, its final show. Yeah, I think I'm right. Yes, that's right. Happy Prince final show today at 2 p.m. at the Octagon Theatre. The Imaginarium is at 3, and then at 5:30 p.m., Ready Set, which is a band. Must try and find some of their music. A band from Girls and Boys High, who sound great. They've been on the show with Matt and they were on Annalise's show, which is called Into the Groovy. I think not last Saturday, but the Saturday before. It's always great to have people in the studio. Right, I'm going to play another track while I see if I can find some Ready Set to play you, because that would be good to put them in the show. So in the meantime, I'll play a song that's on my high rotation. It's the band is Rocket Juice and the Moon with very distinctive vocals by Damon Albarn. This one's called Poison.
For the we are wishing for is poison.
Sorry, that snuck up on me. That was Poison by the Rocket Juice and the something, can't remember what they're called now, I've lost the page. Rocket Juice and the Moon, and Damon Albarn on vocals. So let me just pause that. Okay, let me carry on telling you what else is on today. I got as far as 5:30 p.m. and Ready Set, and if you search up Ready Set on YouTube, you just get something about getting prepared to go into the bush. Ready Set New Zealand. So I don't think they're don't think they have anything. I might have a look on SoundCloud and Bandcamp, because maybe that's more their medium. So there's another show of Barry and Ninja at 6, and then it's also at 6 there is Bull Rush Improv, and I'm thinking I might go to that tonight, because I keep hearing how great they are, and I've always had a bit of an aversion to improv, because when it's terrible, it's a bit like theatre. When it's bad, it's horrible. But I know some of the people in Bull Rush Improv now, and they are quite amusing. I'm talking specifically about Thomas Gowing, who is an extremely funny improviser, and Thomasin Fisher-Johnson, who's quite shy and retiring in person, but on stage, she's a different beast. And Michael Hockey apparently is also in this group. I was hoping to get them in for a chat, but they all work. You'd think they'd just be sort of artistic layabouts, but they seem to be quite high achievers, and they've all got jobs and things, so they'll be flying up, driving extremely fast but safely up to Whangarei tonight to perform at Fringe After Dark at 6 o'clock. And they're quite well, you know, they're quite seasoned performers. They've had seasons in Auckland, Wellington and Christchurch. It's 18 plus, $15 or $10. It's a 1 hour show. So I'm going to try and grab that, see that. And then also, so there's three things at six. There's Barry and Ninja, Bull Rush Improv, and also the Show Me Shorts Film Festival, which is taking place, if I can find it. Oh, God, I can't remember where it is. I'll tell you in a second. Maggie Coco's Science for Sociopaths has a show at 6:30 p.m. tonight, and another one at 8 p.m. tomorrow night at the Octagon Theatre. Also tonight at 6:30 p.m. is Fringe the City, which is a free outdoor event at Pūtahi Park, which is the new park where you can walk through water fountains if you are drunk or a small child. And it's tonight from... Oh, golly, it's not in the program, is it? It's tonight, as it gets dark, there's a fire show once darkness comes in. So Fringe the City at 6:30 p.m. It's in the program somewhere because I've seen it, but it's a half-page thing, and I'm just not really very organized today, but you can look for it and find it. The main thing is it's free, it's family, child friendly, and it goes on till after dark. All right, so that's Fringe the City. Then at 7:30 p.m. Brendan Lovegrove is in action at Fringe After Dark with Bury Me Happy. If you're not familiar with him, he's a very decorated, I should say, the 10-time New Zealand Comedy Guild Best Male Comedian. It's a pretty impressive record. It's a festival favourite and not to be missed. Terrifyingly good was the New Zealand Herald's reviews of him. Saw him once at the Butter Factory, and he is pretty ferocious. And insult comedy, I guess, would be, now that I know there's such a thing, that Brendan Lovegrove indulges in. And the picture of him in the program looks like he's genuinely on the offensive. I don't know, there's something a bit mad about him. Anyway, that's tonight at Fringe After Dark, and also tomorrow night at 7:30, same time, $20 or $18. It's 1 hour, and definitely 18 plus. Okay, then also at 7:30, the first show of Man Lessons, which, and I'm hoping, well, I'm expecting to talk to Adam and... forgotten his name. I'll get it in a minute. Need a coffee. Adam and his collaborator will be in
at 11:30. Man Lessons, the live show, is a coming-of-age story that transcends the patriarchy, values well-being over sanity, and absolves you of the pressure to just be yourself. It's interesting that phrase is used in Like Sex as well. So I'll tell you a bit more. Well, you'll hear a bit more about that later on. So that's Man Lessons. Then at 8 p.m., Nina Lane is performing at the Octagon Theatre. One-hour show, $20 or $18.50. And a contemporary original singer-songwriter, accompanied by Sam Benge on the acoustic double bass and Brian Owens on octave mandolin, guitars and harmony vocals. That sounds like an amazing show. The Climate Imaginaries are back at 8:30 p.m. And they have a sort of installation-type show. Matt talked to them earlier. I might play that interview. I might play that interview again. It's at Whangarei Art Museum tonight. Oh, sorry, it's just the first. It's the one show, one event, which is tonight at 8:30 p.m. It's 1.5 hours. An experimental, improvised sound and visual projection performance exploring themes around the climate crisis, future transitions and transformations. And then the Buskers on the Road Comedy Cabaret is on tonight at 116 at 9 p.m. So this is slightly different to what they're doing this morning at the Cameron Street Mall. The show is led by Zach Tacular and Kozo Chaos. Their stunts will leave jaws on the floor and your hands roar from applause. Magic acts, comedic shenanigans, dangerous stunts, as well as a cast of local guest talent. 18 plus show, and it's $20 or $15 concession. And then finally there's another Soy Boys stand-up comedy show at Fringe After Dark at 9 p.m. So heaps on today. It's feeling like a bit of a marathon, but I'm sure by the time I've warmed up, I'll be in the mood for some more entertainment. Right now, I'm going to play you a track by that I've been getting into by Hamilton Lighthouser called The Silent Orchestra.
Sleep.
was Hamilton Lighthouser and a song called The Silent Orchestra. Right, so Kozo and Zach are here from Buskers on the Road, and they're just having a chocolate Danish while I get a coffee down me and get organized, set up to talk to them in the studio. And that will be fun. And until then, while I do that, I'm going to play a song called Farewell Transmission, which is originally, it's nothing to do with old cars, but it's originally a song by Songs O'Hare. And this version is by Kevin Morby and Waxahachie.
Is dark. Every light on this side of the town. Suddenly it all went down. Now we'll all be brothers of the fossil fire of the sun. Someone must have set him up. Now they'll be working in the cold gray rock. Now they'll be working in the hot mill steam. Now they'll be working in the concrete. In the sirens and silences now, all the great set up hearts, all at once they start to beat. Try, no, whatever we try, forever. The real truth about it is, there ain't no end to the desert I'll cross. With the dead moon in its jar, must be the big star about to fall.
Oh mama, here comes midnight. With the dead moon in its jar, must be the big star about to fall.
Oh mama, here comes midnight. With the dead moon in its jar, must be the big star about to fall. Long dark blue.
Will of the winds.
Long dark blue. The big star is falling. Long dark. Big star is falling. Long dark blue.
Through the static and distance.
Long dark blue. A farewell transmission. Long dark blue. Listen. Long dark blue. Listen. Long dark blue. Listen. Long dark blue.
Listen.
Welcome back to Fringe Radio. That was The Villagers and Everything I Am Is Yours. And welcome to Kozo and Zach from Buskers on the Road.
Hello.
Hey.
You guys arrived in Whangarei last night, right?
Yeah.
And where did you come from?
We drove up from Auckland.
Okay. Yeah. So you're based in Auckland?
I'm based in Auckland. Kozo's based in Wellington. We've actually been on like a road trip all the way from Wellington.
Oh, together.
For the past 2 weeks.
Yeah. This has been like a 2 week trip.
Oh,
from Wellington, and then you've just been making our way slowly up here, and then Whangarei's our last stop.
And have you been doing performances on the way?
Yeah, all okay. the way along, yeah.
So you're real buskers, like you just rock up somewhere and start performing?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Just kind of drop our stuff on the pitch, make a lot of noise.
But I mean, this one's a bit more organized, so we did get councils and everything.
Do you have to get a license to busk?
Depends on the place.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay. Some places like Auckland and Wellington, obviously, have like quite strict rules around it. Yeah. And then some places like Napier, Hastings...
They're pretty chill.
Like they're just like, oh, you're doing
probably
what?
Don't even cool. know we were there.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. So you've never been asked to move on?
No.
Okay. Not recently.
Not in New Zealand. Because I think that happens in other cities. Like if you can...
I busk in Melbourne quite a lot, and you have to audition to get a permit there. And
really?
If you don't have a permit, you can get fined or
get
arrested.
Who auditions you? Like what are the criteria?
Depends what you do. But like for me, if I do fire or knives, I have to get assessed by a fellow street performer and a council member.
Okay. Fire or knives, because I guess there's a health and safety dimension to that.
They just want to make sure you're not a crazy person.
Right. I mean, crazy, you know, I guess there's a sort of element of crazy in your description, you know, is emphasizing the sort of, extreme, well, not extreme, but like, is that what you're going for? Like, what's your sort of, how would you describe the show?
Organized chaos?
The word, chaos. Right.
Organized chaos, that's a nice way to put it.
And do you sort of interact with each other in the show? Like, are you sort of...
Yeah, there's a little bit of back and forth. Right. We should explain that we're doing three separate shows during the day.
Right.
But we'll be out on Cameron Street Mall.
Right.
And then I will be doing my solo street show, and Kozo will be doing his own solo street show as well.
At the mall.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, and in the evening we're going to be doing a cabaret, which is the two of us together, and there's a bit of back and forth.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
And we're doing totally different things to what we do in our solo street shows.
Oh,
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
You've got that much material.
Yeah, oh, man. Surprisingly, we do.
Got heaps.
There's
too
a lot
much.
That's not in the show.
Yeah.
Either.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Honestly, too much to show anybody in one sitting.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So you've linked up with some local performers as well, according to the.
We tried to.
Yeah,
we
tried.
A lot of the local talent is wrapped up in their own shows here in the Fringe.
Oh,
good. So
and they're not able to share.
Yeah. Also, I have friends that have done Fringe already, like the first and second weeks, so they're already out of here.
Okay.
You said you got some friends who also have a show on at the same time.
Yeah.
Don't go to their
show.
Come to ours.
Oh. Okay. Which is that today? You got some friends who got a show on at the same time?
Yeah, I got my friends from Soy Boys. That are on at the same time, literally.
Right.
Yeah. They're good friends of mine from Wellington. But
right. So you're here tonight. You're here at 116 tonight for the cabaret.
Yeah.
And then, you're right. The Soy Boys are at the Fringe After Dark at the same time.
Yeah.
But you do have another cabaret here tomorrow night at 10. So if people were worried about missing the Soy Boys... then they can catch you again here tomorrow night at 10.
Yeah. Or just come to our show twice.
Yeah, there's no limit. If you see
it could be slightly different.
It could be slightly
different.
Different
things go wrong each time.
I see, and that's an enjoyable part of it for the audience when things go wrong.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. There's definitely some moments along this tour that we've done where the audience saw something go wrong and they had a great time.
We've broken some stuff.
Yeah, I've broken a lot of stuff.
What's an example of that happening?
Oh, in Hastings, Hastings, we actually had a really great turnout for our cabaret in Hastings.
At a venue?
A venue.
Where did you play?
We were at the...
Common Room.
It's an awesome... If you're ever in Hastings, it's an awesome spot to go. It's a nice little bar venue.
Right.
They put on, like, all sorts of, like, stand-up and bands and all sorts. I the finale of our show, of our cabaret, is an act that I've recently been developing... Over the past like broad strokes couple of years in like fine detail in the past couple of months, and basically at the climax of the act there's about $160 worth of crockery spinning on the top of some flimsy wooden poles.
$160 worth.
Yeah,
I'm assuming you know that figure because you've broken it.
I tried so many different things, and it turns out that the more expensive things work better, which is really unfortunate.
Why is that?
Oh, it's just the bowls are just, I guess they've got a bit more weight, that the shape of them is a bit better.
Right.
Yeah.
So the cheap ones aren't so good.
Yeah, the cheap ones just slip off and smash. And right. So I already spent like more money than is reasonable for any adult in their entire lifetime.
Pretty much after every show, if we find a warehouse, we'll stop in and buy more bowls.
Oh. So you can buy this expensive crockery at the warehouse.
Yeah. They're $20 each.
So yeah.
Are they?
Yeah.
Each item.
Yeah, each item.
Oh, wow.
Okay, so you were telling me about the finale in Hastings. What happened?
Well, I mean, I don't know what happened. A freak gust of gravity. gravity. One of these things slipped off the pole as I was, and by the way, they're spinning on top of the poles. It's spinning eight bowls on top of eight poles.
At the same time. And you're looking after eight?
All eight.
At the back just watching.
Oh. Yeah, just watching, waiting for something to go.
Yeah, hoping one of them breaks.
Everybody loves that.
Yeah.
It's nerve-wracking for me, and I've been told it's pretty nerve-wracking for the audience as well. But one of these bowls just slipped, and I was there. I tried to catch it as it was going down.
Yeah.
It landed on the sort of the base of the... of the stand that they're on, and just snapped in half, and you can see I've got this little, this nice little X-shaped cut right there, which I thought I covered really well. I thought nobody would have noticed, but then as we're outroing the show, just the blood starts seeping down around my forearm.
It's very noticeable. I'm like, oh, that's a lot of blood running down your arm.
So this was close to the end of the show.
Oh, this was the climax of the show. This was the end. We were
As we were doing our final bells, I look over. I'm like, I think there's been an accident.
Yeah. Guys, fortunately, there were a couple nurses in the audience.
Yeah.
Really? So this guy's bleeding for his art. That's impressive.
Literally. Life and limb, every time.
So, Zach, how did you get into doing this sort of performance? Like, what's your story?
I sort of got into circus and juggling and fire performing as a young teenager, like around when I was 13.
Where were you living at the time? How did you?
I'm from Auckland,
right?
I'm from Auckland.
And was this stuff sort of going on? Because we've got Circus Kumarani here, which is cool. Who was your, you know, which organization were you with?
There used to be a group in Auckland called the Central City Circus. They were like a really great sort of group. Most of them are still around performing and doing various things around the country. But I sort of got in with them and was just like a bit of a fanboy. Loved it. Didn't realize that it was going to become my career until I was about 19, and I went off to a circus school in Christchurch.
Oh, yeah.
And then, since then I've been, you know, I've performed with most of the circuses that operate within New Zealand, quite a lot overseas. I've performed in over 200 festivals around the world.
Wow. And, so how old are you now, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm 33.
So 33. So
20 years.
So you've had a 20-year involvement with circus.
Yeah, and probably about a 15, 16-year career, like a professional career.
And I mean, you know, running off and joining the circus is not generally considered a good career move, but you know, was school hard for you? Like, what were your kind of options as a young person?
I did quite well at school, although I wasn't hugely enthused by it. I had a bit of direction. I come from a hospitality family.
Right.
We're reasonably well known in Auckland. Do you know Auckland at all?
Not really.
No. Well, have you ever been? Some of your listeners might know the White Lady.
Oh, the White Lady.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah, I know the White Lady.
So I'm one of the White Lady people. Like my brother runs it now, my father ran it for 50 years, and my grandfather opened it.
It's quite an institution, isn't it? Off Queen Street, is it? Or was it the same place?
Yeah, it's just down there, Queen Street, just off Ford Street, actually. But so I grew up thinking, when I'm 30, I'm going to have to take over the family business because my brother was a real estate agent when I was younger. He was into sales. He was not interested in the family business particularly.
Mm.
And I always sort of saw it like, oh, I better live hard, fast, you know, follow my dream as much as possible. Before I have to jump in and help with a family business and carry on that legacy.
Yeah.
And it was about when I was like maybe 26, 27, my brother had a bit of a breakdown about like doing real estate.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember him saying, "Real estate, it's a job for a middle-aged woman, something like that." So to that effect, he was just like, he was like 30, 35.
Wasn't doing it for him.
Yeah, he's just like, this is the wrong career, and he just went fully into the white lady, and I was like, oh my God, thank you so, so much. Thank you so much. I was having way too much fun.
Right.
I was not ready to give up this lifestyle and this career.
Cool. Yeah. And you're still loving it?
I still love it.
Is there a point where you're, obviously you're not there yet, but like where your body can no longer do this kind of work?
If you take good care of yourself, you can do so much. And there's such a variety. Like I do quite a big variety. So does Kozo. We're both jugglers, quite high skilled jugglers. Mm. That's something, it is physical, but there's quite a range that you can do.
Mm.
As far as acrobatics goes, I used to do flips and tumble a lot. I've busted like every joint in my body multiple times.
Right.
I'm just too big for that really, but I can still do great handstands and hand balancing acts. And I do have my signature acrobatic act that is in my street show.
Mm.
And we're kind of trying to decide whether I just chuck it into the
cabaret.
Yeah.
It's a big space.
It is a big space. It'll go off.
I was going to ask about that because, you know, you said about the bar in Hastings. I'm thinking, you know, what sort of headroom do you need? Like what kind of clearance do you guys need?
We're pretty adaptable.
Yeah. Oh, okay, so you can tailor it to the venue.
Yeah. Yeah, we can do it in a real pokey space. Obviously, we prefer having a bit of room to move. But
so 116 will be good because it's a nice big space.
Massive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Kozo, what about you? How did you get into this sort of stuff?
Kind of similar, but pretty much I grew up watching the circus. My family's pretty close with the Weber family from Weber Rubber Circus.
How come?
I don't know. We just became fans, I guess. We used to go to the shows like every week. I mean, we kind of...
Where was this? When you were living in Auckland?
Yeah, well, I was living in Auckland. It was in Devonport, actually. They had their tent set up just down the road.
Right.
And then I watched the show for the first... I was like 9 years old. And I was like, this is amazing. And I was like, let's go back next week. And we kind of became close friends. We'd watch the shows. And I started just teaching myself tricks. I learned magic first.
Oh.
And then like in school, I was doing card tricks with my friends.
Oh, yeah.
And then my sister picked up juggling.
Mm-hmm.
And then she was juggling like 5 balls in like 2 or 3 months. I was like, oh, juggling must be easy.
Yeah, right.
It was not.
No.
It took me way longer.
Yeah.
But then I became a juggler. But later on, I picked up magic again. But
right.
Yeah. Just self-taught. And then...
is there magic in your show?
Yes, there is. Quite a few magic tricks in the cabaret.
Right.
Yeah, in the cabaret Yeah. And then just grew up doing tricks. I joined the circus.
Which one did you join?
I was on and off. I did a few like shows with Webers, and then I did Circus Aotearoa.
Mm-hmm.
And then after I left the circus, I started doing my own shows and started doing street performance and all that.
Right. So you're not. You guys are quite mobile then. Like, what have you got in terms of gear? Like, do you have a big van full of stuff? Or
we've got a station wagon. Yeah. beg your pardon. Yeah. A station wagon that's packed pretty tight at the moment because it's. Usually, like, my show is, like, a big suitcase and a bag.
Mm.
Kozo's show is a big suitcase and a ladder. But then we've got all this extra gear because the cabaret has, like, all of our... all of the cabaret gear. Yeah,
we got, like, 2 tables and our clothes and costumes. You should check out the car. It's a good, like, Tetris job.
Right.
Yeah.
Nice.
Packed quite nicely.
So how did you guys end up working together? Like, when did that happen?
I mean, like, to be honest, we've just always been in the same community, and there, I guess, kind of, like, in circus and a lot of other performing arts, like, there are a lot of people who come in and they'll give it a go for a couple of years, and maybe they fade away, drift off into something else,
or
find another passion, but we've both just been doing it for so long that we kind of just drifted into each other. Right. It's just like, well, I know Kozo's good, seen him, known him for years.
Right.
We're both from Auckland as well.
Yeah, and so...
Yeah.
Are you about the same age, Kozo? Have you been going
I'm
that
30.
Long? Right, so you've got the same sort of performing history as...
Yeah, like, because I've been doing this professionally for like 13 years now.
Wow.
And I've been juggling for 15 years.
Right.
So. Similar, right?
Yeah, similar sort of time frame.
Yeah.
And were your parents a bit like, no, don't join the circus? Or did they think it was, you know, did
well,
they...
Well, I'm Japanese, right? I
was, yeah.
But, yeah, my parents kind of... I'm like, oh, you know, they're not like the typical Asian parents. Like, oh, go to uni, get a degree, be a doctor or whatever. But they were pretty happy. Like, they knew I was enjoying it.
Yeah.
They knew I didn't like school as well. I did finish high school properly. Yeah. Mm. I was going to become a graphic designer.
Oh, yeah.
But I failed maths in high school.
Oh.
And to go to uni to study graphic design, I had to have maths, like level 3 maths.
Oh.
I failed it. So I was like, oh, I can't even go to uni anyway. So oh, I was so like, hey, I'm going to be a self-employed performer. I'd be like, cool.
Great.
Awesome, do it.
Oh.
Yeah.
So you didn't have to run away. And so you kind of sounds like both your families sort of supported your...
Yeah, you know, a very supportive family.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Families, both of us.
And so making a living at doing this, is that a constant struggle or is it fairly stable now?
It's got ups and downs, for sure. You learn quite early on that you have to have a bit of a nest egg, put something away, because sometimes it does rain.
Yeah.
There are dead seasons, and we just had obviously COVID. That
sometimes a pandemic happens.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a bit
pandemic
of a...
Pandemic happens without and you don't warning. Really have any work for a year or two.
Yeah. Oh, shit. But, yeah, so what did you do then? Like, did you have a nest egg or did you diversify or...
Oh, yeah, a bit of both. I did. I was living in Germany before that. I was, like, you were... Some people might have heard about on the radio that they were doing, like, drive-in discos and
during the pandemic
and stuff. Mm. And I did a few drive-in cabarets that was
as a performer.
Yeah,
so how would that work? People would drive their car into a place and what?
Literally like a big car park.
Yeah.
Like a big car park where they set up a stage, a massive stage at one end with a couple of screens, and then they'd put on a variety show and everybody would just honk their horns instead of clapping. It was awesome. I got told off because I was trying to go like, hey, everybody rev your engines. Oh. Like, come on, like, let's... Like, kick it up.
Right.
And they were like, no, you can't do that. This is not cool.
So were you in Germany when the pandemic hit?
Yeah. No, I was here, but I was here, but on holiday and got stranded with my family.
Oh.
And which, worst places to be. But
with your family? You've got a family of your own?
I do now.
Oh.
I do now. I've got a daughter now, uh-huh. But with my parents,
me and my
fiance, we'd come home to, like, you know, see everybody for Christmas,
mm-hmm.
and then everything shut down, obviously,
and
we were like, oh, we can't get back to Germany, back to our apartment.
So that's where you were based, you were living at the time.
Yeah, I was living there for 8 years, and just coming here for summers, but now, and then I had to go back, and we packed up everything, and now we've resettled here for the time being anyway.
Right. And how is it for your partner and your daughter, you being a circus performer?
Oh, well, my daughter's 11 months old, so she honestly doesn't care. It's kind of disappointing.
It's quite a cool thing for your dad to be at some point.
Yeah,
she'll appreciate
at some point I'm sure she'll love it, but at the moment it's... I mean, like, she just, all the tricks and stuff, she just stares at me blankly.
Yeah.
There's been a few things that she really likes.
Oh.
But,
well, I guess it's, you know, good entertainment for your daughter, and she'll probably get into it. What about you, Kozo? Have you got, you know, like, have you got a family, or are you still sort of, because I'm guessing this lifestyle could be quite difficult if you want to have a relationship.
Yeah,
and things
it
like
is.
That.
It is hard. I'm constantly like moving around. Like, I mean, I was based in Melbourne for a little bit before the pandemic hit.
Yeah.
I mean, I have been here in New Zealand for 2 years now.
Mm.
But recently, I did go to London and Australia as well. And like, my next summer is looking busy in and out of Australia every UK and all that. So I am always traveling, so it's a little bit hard.
Right.
But,
and do you set all that up yourself, or do you have an agent? How do you kind of get the work? Are you...
Bit of both. Like, I try and look for work as well, but then I get work from people seeing my stuff, like, online, Facebook and Instagram, or they saw me do a show somewhere.
Mm.
I've got friends who are producers, and I've got, like, agents as well. But
right.
Just a mix of everything.
Right.
Everything. Yeah.
So it's definitely kind of... rev back up to normal kind of speed, the industry, the gigs
I feel
that you're getting?
Yeah, it's picked up again this year.
So what's the buzz for you about doing this? Like, what do you get out of it? Like, what's the kind of, you know, what do you love about the work?
I think I really like traveling, being able to travel. Yeah. And then do my shows wherever I am as well, meeting new people. And I've got friends all over the world, so like it's always nice to just see them.
Is it quite a tight community, the circus community? Like, is
you can become fast friends with like so many people wherever you go doing this sort of thing.
And are you always like picking up new stuff, like new skills, new material, new ideas? Yeah. Do you kind of, is it kind of like... What's the kind of thing about copyright? Like, are you, you know, can you rip people off?
Oh, it's a weird
adaptations. Yeah, it's one of those gray areas. Like, like with lots of arts, like imitation is like not. Yeah, there's like a sort of gray area with like using other people's material, like adapting their material. Mm. Obviously, within the realm of circus, there's like so much is based upon props. For instance, like. We can't invent a new juggling.
Yeah,
you know, juggling. It's only
generic. No one's got a trademark on juggling.
I juggle knives. Zach juggles knives, but then like we present it in a different way. Yeah, you know,
right.
There's a lot of that. Like I'm doing this plate spinning act, which is an ancient practice. I think it originated in China from pot spinning and stuff. That's a real classic Chinese. But like then it's been popularized through circus and variety shows for decades and decades. Mm. And to be honest, it's kind of hard to get away from the simple act of just getting a whole lot of pots spinning at the same time.
Yeah.
The act writes itself in a way. But it's awesome that way. It doesn't need to be changed.
And I guess it's I don't know how much sort of talking you do during the show, but I'm guessing it's you can go to any country and be able to communicate with an audience through your medium.
I mean, it's really visual, so everybody, you know, you see the trick.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
Have you ever had a problem with, like, sort of that? Is there a level, an amount of verbal communication with your audience, Kozo? How do you find that?
I don't know. Most of the places I've been to, you know, the English speaking as well, but like even like places like Japan, they kind of know a bit of English.
Yeah.
But for me, I can speak Japanese, so I've got that advantage.
And have you performed in Japan?
A little bit, yeah. It's weird. Japan's a weird place. I can't get booked because even though technically I'm Kiwi, but I look Japanese. So they wouldn't book a Kiwi performer that looks Japanese.
Really?
Because, I don't know. Because, they can just book a Japanese performer.
And is this a tradition in Japan, this kind of street performing and circus? Is it a thing?
I mean, there's lots of street performers and, like, lots of variety shows and all that. But street performing is a lot harder in Japan, I guess. Because, again, like, you know, laws and auditions and all that. It's very strict over there. Yeah. So. I never really have the chance to actually do any shows when I'm in Japan.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So let's wrap this up. So just get a sense of. So you're doing. It's on the website, but the programs are a little bit misleading. So you're doing daytime shows at Cameron Street Mall today, and Friday and Saturday.
Yep. 12 to 4 p.m. It's me and Zach Tacular doing our solo street performing shows.
Right.
Yep. So we'll be doing two shows each. You know, like we'll be doing, you know, I'll have a go or Kozo will have a go. We flip a coin to decide who goes first.
Mm-hmm.
And then we both do a show and then there's a short break and then we'll do that again for anybody who comes late.
Because no one's likely to be there for the whole 4 hours. Eh?
Oh, no. I mean, like, they're welcome to.
Yeah,
they're welcome to.
We've had people do that.
Yeah. Really?
Like in Napier. They just watched all the shows.
Yeah. Cool. And that's a Koha all free, but it says also somewhere... I can't remember where I read it. Bring some cash, you know.
Yeah. It's a busking show. If you don't have to pay, you don't have to pay.
But you should. Yeah.
You should pay, but you don't have to pay.
Yeah. Fair enough. That's a nice distinction. This is where you wrote free to attend, but bring some cash to show support. You know.
Yeah.
So that's great. It's nice. It's nice that it's very accessible. And then the cabaret tonight, so you've got two cabarets, Thursday the 13th here at 116 at 9 p.m. and Friday the 14th tomorrow at 10 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a cabaret, so it'll be still you doing some individual stuff.
Yeah.
And so, some other people as well, or just you two? Or
This time round, it'll just be us two, unless we can find a guest for tonight and tomorrow night.
Okay. Yeah, so the call is out for anyone out there.
Yeah, just message us on Instagram or whatever.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Normally, because every town we go to, we want to bring in like a guest performer.
Yeah. Sure.
Spot. Yeah.
Sure. Okay. I wonder if Hannah's still here because they might know someone. I've got an idea, but yeah, it'd be good to have some local. You'd welcome local people.
Yeah, definitely.
Would you audition them first to make sure they're any good?
I mean, we could do it in the car park out here.
Yeah, yeah. Just got to have a tight 5-minute performance of some form.
Yeah. So you know that's the kind of idea that you'd let them be on stage for about 5 minutes and then they'd
pretty much in between. Yeah.
Awesome.
But yeah, the cabaret is us two doing our individual acts.
Mm.
It's some that we do together as well, but
yep.
It's everything that we don't do in our daytime street shows.
Right.
So even if you come to the daytime shows, you can come back to the night show and it's totally different.
Yeah. Awesome. Put the kids to bed and come and see some of the some other stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, so and I can't remember there being a show as late as 10 in this Fringe. So it's great.
I think it'll be the only show.
Yeah.
That's on at 10. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's cool. Great. Two great days of Fringe stuff and so awesome. Well, it's been really good to meet you two. Thanks for coming in and good luck with the show. So I'm guessing you'll be heading down to Cameron Street Mall to get set up.
Yeah, we're going to start at 12 today, which is like an hour.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's enough time to get a snack.
Yes, get yourself fed and I will keep promoting the show on the radio and good luck and hope to see you. I'm hoping to catch you tonight.
Awesome.
We'll save your seat. 1-6. Thank you. Appreciate it. Well, thanks for coming in, guys.
Well, thanks for having us.
I'm going to chuck the playlist back on while I get organized for the next guest.
Cool.
That's Kozo and Zach from Buskers on the Road. Welcome to Whangarei.
Thank you.
Lovely to be here. I want to take you for a ride into another dimension. I should have let it lie. Well, I would if I could have, but I got no tongue to let you bite. I'm looking like a fool, I guess I should have let it go. Well, I should have just let it slide. I should have just let it slide. Every time she looks my way, I hold my heart in my hands. I can't believe what I am saying, but I just can't turn the other cheek. I just can't turn the other cheek. I guess I should.
want to welcome back to Fringe Radio. We've got one more hour to go, and we're talking to the Soy Boys now, Oren and Finn. And then at 11:30, we've got Adam from Man Lessons. So welcome to the studio, Oren and Finn. You've already had one show here at Fringe After Dark.
Yes, we have.
Cool. And
it's last night.
Yeah, it's a nice venue, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a gorgeous venue.
Yeah.
It's quite big as well.
You just walk in and it says, you know, sort of not sleazy comedy venue, but like, you know, those curtains, if you look, don't look too closely, they're kind of old and, you know, a bit tatty, and yeah, I like the vibe. Yeah. So your title of your show is Soy Boys, and definitely in your description in the program there's a sort of milk theme. where did that come from? Like, what's the, you know, how did you decide on that?
So there's a sort of there's an idea in the States around sort of right-wing groups where they are labeling sort of more left-wing, more effeminate men as soy boys.
Okay. So it's a put-down to some sort of non-macho version of masculinity kind of thing.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Right. And we kind of felt that that described us.
Uh-huh. and you're kind of maybe reclaiming it as a sort of like, you know, a badge of honor to be a kind of more, I don't know, what would you call it? Like, because in the spectrum of masculinity, there's basically kind of alpha male and gay at the two ends.
Yeah.
And exactly. So, you know, I thought metrosexual was sort of like somewhere in between.
Yeah.
And so, but metrosexual was not necessarily a put down. It was more like a trying to find some space on the spectrum for people who aren't gay.
It was more of a trend, really, wasn't it?
I guess so, yeah. So you're kind of referencing that. Okay, and people in New Zealand familiar with that as a sort of a thing? Because I definitely wasn't. Like, I read it and I was like, okay, what is this about?
Very few people are.
Okay, do you explain that in the show?
Not really. Okay. Not really.
Okay.
Like, but I think that kind of works. It still works fine. As long as people get, they have maybe just have a feeling of what it might be.
Yeah.
And I guess it also kind of means that we can talk about whatever we want
outside
of stuff about masculinity, which I think we had material about that.
Right.
That's why we were together.
Okay. Oh, yeah. See, so that was sort of what drew you together to do a show together, kind of?
Yeah, well, we're both sort of working towards having longer stand-up comedy sets, and we both have roughly half an hour now, and our material is somewhat similar, has similar themes around.
Sort of complements each other.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. Right.
Mm. Yeah. So, yeah, that's why we decided to partner up for this show.
And how long have you been working together, doing the show?
Well, including the hour last night. probably. We've known each other for a couple of years now.
Yeah.
But in terms of working time together, probably an hour.
Oh, so last night was your debut?
Yeah, and then I guess we've just been performing on the same lineup shows in Wellington for a couple of years now.
Yeah.
Just developing our stuff individually.
Cool. So I understand from talking to stand-up comedians through the Fringe, you know, the sort of start-off seems to be like a 10-minute set, and then you can do lineups, and then you can kind of like expand it to half an hour, and then you can do a split-bill show, like I guess is what yours is. Is it a split-bill show? You're not on together. You're doing separate sets.
Yeah, we're not on stage at the same time.
And then an hour. So then the kind of the holy grail, according to, I was talking to Ryan McGee. I don't know if you've met him.
Yes, of course. Oh, yeah.
You probably know each other.
Yeah, it's very tight knit.
Okay. And he was talking about getting up to that hour where you can do an hour on your own, and then he said you get an agent.
Essentially, I do.
Right.
Well, that sounds good.
Yeah.
is that the goal? Like, so you've both been working in stand-up for about 2 years, did you say, in Wellington?
Yeah.
Give or take,
2 years-ish. Mm. Ish. I mean, you don't really... 2020 is a weird year because you couldn't hardly perform.
Right.
But I guess we were stand-up comedians then.
Mm.
But yeah, I guess that is the goal. I'm not sure. We maybe have similar takes where we just are focusing on comedy and are not too good with the whole business or marketing or admin.
Yeah. Right. Because you've got to be good at that stuff too, or
I think inevitably
you have to promote yourself.
Inevitably you have to do it.
You are kind of the product and the marketer. And
right.
You are the whole.
I guess that's the beauty of it, is it's quite portable, isn't it? In terms of overheads, you know, it's just you.
Well, exactly. Right. That's kind of the appeal of what drew me to it in the first place, is that once you get your first hour, you can go anywhere, and yeah, as long as you have a venue and seats for people to sit in, that's, you've got a show.
Yeah. So when did you realize that you were funny, or when did you kind of like, you know, there must have been a moment where you thought, because I wouldn't do stand up, like, I just don't think I'm that funny, but you must have had a moment where you're like, and sometimes I think, was it because you were a little shit at school and you would, you know, you're pissing the teachers off but everyone was laughing, or like, when was it for you, Finn?
Well, it's funny, a lot of people ask my sister that question.
And whether about you?
Well, yeah, because my sister comes to quite a lot of my stand-up shows, and people ask her, like, well, was he, like, funny as a kid? And more often than not, she says no.
Yeah.
She was more the funny one. So I honestly don't think that I was, like, I don't know if people would have seen me as a kid and been like, he's going to be a stand-up comedian. I think it was more so, I did, like, drama and things at the time, and then it just sort of, stand-up comedy is a... an offshoot of theatre, which is, again, more portable.
Yeah.
But also, it's a lot more fun.
Really? More fun than theatre?
I would say, in a few ways. And in some ways, theatre is more fun than stand-up comedy, but it's... I don't know. I think it's a lot more lighthearted, and I think I enjoy it a lot more. And again, I think it's more of a skill that you learn to write jokes and deliver jokes, and you can be not funny at the start, and then after a few years... develop that that muscle, that skill.
So it's definitely a sort of a craft that you have to develop, as well as having a kind of I don't know, like a take on the world. You must have some sort of, you know, I guess as a stand-up you've got to have an opinion on everything or start something.
Yeah,
what would you say your material kind of is about generally, like, is it because observational, is that
that's a style. A lot of
Alexander Sparrow came in earlier in this week, and he was like, insult comedy, that's where I'm at. And then I went to see his show, and I was like, I totally understand what that genre of comedy is.
Oren,
what's your kind of
I think we're both kind of similar, but I guess we generally we have some quite personal stories, storytelling, and yeah, I guess there's sometimes stories that turn out to be funny.
Yeah.
I guess. And I think...
don't sound funny to begin
with. Yeah, I think that's the thing. Like, I think... like, I realized I was funny, or at least some of my experiences were funny, when I just told the truth.
Yeah.
And that's... and I'm often up on stage thinking, why are they laughing?
Yeah.
And then I get off and ask, well, why was that funny? And it's just something kind of unfortunate. And then there's the other half where I've got, I think that might be funny, and it takes me a while to work out why that is funny.
But those sorts of experiences happen to all of us. So exactly. It's really just the way you tell them, isn't it, as a comedian?
Exactly. And we were staying, with someone at the moment, and he was a bus driver in the crowd, and we didn't know that. And so we turned up to his house afterwards to say, and then there was the person in the crowd.
Wait, so this is here in Whangarei?
Here in Whangarei, yes. Wait,
so the person you're staying with... here in Whangarei is a bus driver.
He came to the show, and at the start we did a little bit of talking to the crowd, and got to know this guy who was a bus driver. Made a couple jokes in and around him, nothing too mean or anything.
Luckily.
And then we arrived back at the place that we were staying and realized that it was him. It was because we hadn't actually spoken face to face before.
Oh, I see. So they're people billeting you, putting you up for the show, for the festival.
Okay. Yeah, exactly.
So carry on.
Yeah, but I mean, he was talking about how in our stories, it was just the fact that we were just telling stories that relate to people, even though they're our very, maybe like personal and individual experiences, but everyone has something or a memory that they can really quite strongly relate to it. And they're willing to listen to those parts in kind of a nice way.
Yeah.
And then the joke lands, and then it turns out to be funny.
Yeah, because we're always expecting a punchline, aren't we? We're there to laugh. Like, we're there because we want to be entertained. Mm. But also I think there's something very compelling about a story, isn't there? Like, we love listening to stories. So the minute someone starts telling me a story, I'm there.
Exactly.
And all right, so maybe would you be willing to share with us one little kind of thing that you talk about in the show, like an anecdote that would, you know, the kind of thing, could give us a taste of the kind of thing?
Do you want to share the doctor story?
The doctor story? Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'll tell this story because I didn't actually tell this last night, but there were a couple of doctors at the show, and we met them afterwards, and I told them the story. So my last girlfriend was in 2019, Uh-huh. And we didn't actually spend much time together because she... Well, we were both quite busy at that time.
Yeah.
And she was... she was had a quite a big following on social media. And she was a professional dancer.
Oh.
And she was also in her fourth year of med, studying med.
Wow.
And I had stuff on as well. And... And as I found out, med was killing all of her time, right?
Yeah, it tends to be all-consuming, I think.
Exactly, yeah, it's ridiculous hours, lots of study. Mm. And so when you're in your fourth year of med, you get placed in a surgery team in a hospital.
Right.
And you're not performing, you're just in the theatre observing things. And while we were going out, she was in the colorectal surgery team.
Right.
As in rectal surgery, yeah. Right?
Right, right.
And everything was going fine. And then one day she just came into my flat and said, I can't do this anymore.
And talking about colorectal surgery or the relationship?
That's exactly the joke. I don't even have to finish it.
That, sorry.
And that's exactly it. But that was it. And, you know, it turns out she was talking about me.
Oh.
But that's... And you so, clip that. That's the sort of heaviness that you might get in our show. And then it turns out to be funny. I didn't tell that one last night, by the way.
Okay,
I
right.
I just told that to the two very concerned doctors after the show.
I see. Yeah. And I'm sure they could relate to that. But yeah, so self-deprecating is the kind of the word that comes to mind. Is that would that be a good description of your sort of comedic style? Like, because you know your girlfriend had to choose between colorectal surgery and you.
Yes.
And she chose colorectal surgery.
She was looking at anal fissures.
Yeah. Oh God.
Yeah, but I guess sometimes it's self-deprecating, but often it comes out the other side, and you're making jokes where the audience. It's also uplifting at the same time.
Yeah.
And you have both of those. It can't just be sad. No. It can't just be sad, even if it is funny as well. I think the audience, they like to know that we're all good. And we are all good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. What about you, Finn? What could give us an example? Give us a taste of your stuff? Like what? Yeah. And sorry to put you on the spot.
It is a bit... we do have quite similar... We discussed last night after listening to the show and listening to us doing both the half hours.
Oh, you record it?
We didn't record this one, but we're recording it this evening. We do usually record our sets.
Do a post mortem and think what worked and what didn't?
Essentially, yeah. Hopefully, it's not a post mortem.
Yeah, that's the wrong term.
Unless we killed.
Yeah, true. Unless, yes, yep, right.
But no, we do usually go back and sort of dig apart what happened and. What landed, what didn't land, how can we change it, and stuff like that. Mm. We did notice, though, a lot of our jokes sort of start with, this really awful thing happened to me.
Oh, yeah.
And then we find a way to make it funny.
Yeah, that's quite a compelling beginning to a story. I'm already interested. What was the really awful thing? Can you give us a...
I moved into a new flat relatively recently, and this is true. I didn't realize how shit the new place was. I don't know if we can...
No, you can swear. We encourage swearing on this radio station.
Oh, amazing.
We've got no advertisers to piss off, so you say what the fuck you like.
Ah, beautiful. I didn't realize how shit the new place was until I moved in.
Mm.
For example, just a few off the top of my head, I went to put a wash on first night that I was there, and a cockroach crawled out of the washing machine, which... You know, it's the cleanest place in the house.
right. Okay. So the comedian's skill is to turn something like that, which happens into, you know, you've got to kind of think it through for us. Because, yeah, I'm there with the cockroach in the washing machine. That's weird, but you kind of, the cleanest, theoretically the cleanest place in the house.
Exactly.
So what was the pantry like?
Yeah, like opening up the fridge and finding the sun. I don't know.
Yeah.
What else is going on in that flat? Yeah.
I see. Right. Cool. Yeah, so do you think as a comedian you have to kind of go out and have those experiences, or do you feel like everyday life provides enough material?
I don't know if we necessarily go out and do research.
Because relationships and, you know, what you're describing, moving into a flat, you know, they're all common experiences that we have, aren't they?
Mm.
Is relationships quite a big part of your sets, like talking about being in relationships?
Probably is for me.
Yeah?
Mm. I don't know. That might sound bad, but yeah, no, it is. I guess
it's very universal, isn't it? Something we can all understand and relate to.
Yeah, exactly. And I think because it is a kind of a good concept, but what I'm very careful of in terms of going out and having experiences, that I'm never going into experiences thinking, oh, this might be good comedy material.
Yeah.
Because then it kind of loses the authenticity.
Yeah.
And usually it's not until, for me at least, a couple months later until I write about it and then find the humour or realise that it was funny at the time.
Mm.
But I think I just don't like the idea of using experiences for comedy.
Yeah.
Or using genuine, authentic relationships.
Yeah, sort of, yeah, there must be limits. Like your partner probably doesn't want you, you know, airing your dirty laundry in public or you know, doing that sort of thing. And do you know Thomas Chapman? Is he a...
Oh, yeah, love Thomas.
he was up here for The Fringe and he told us a story in the studio. He was here with Gavin Hewitson about going to an orgy. Have you heard that story?
I have heard that story.
Oh, my God. It's funny because other comedians have asked, they've all heard the story, and I'm like, why isn't it in your show, Thomas? And he's like, oh, that's just me living my life. And maybe that's an example of you saying that not everything is necessarily material.
Yeah.
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 So who are some comedians... I've been exposed to some really, like... his name slips my mind, but there's some out there comedians that I've never heard of that people have talked about. Who are your kind of go-tos for...
I'd say my biggest inspirations would probably be someone like Stuart Lee.
You heard of Stuart Lee? Yeah, I do know Stuart Lee.
Yeah.
I really like Stuart Lee. He comes across as very smart.
Yeah, he's very, very clever.
Yeah.
Yeah, but also a bit neurotic and almost falling apart at times.
Yeah.
Which is, I just think, is a beautiful energy to capture on
stage. Do you think, is that a persona or is that...
Yeah, so it is a persona.
Yeah.
Because
he writes reviews and things like that for The Guardian as well. Like, he's quite a, you know, he's quite diverse in his... And I saw something the other day which I, you know, said, look, he's grown a beard and he looks like he might be becoming a bit of a derelict. And I'm like, he's just doesn't seem like that kind of, you know, self-destructive comedian. Like, there's a thing about comedians, you know, sometimes they can be quite self-destructive. They can be sort of like on the edge of, you know, suicidal despair as well as being funny, you know, that kind of thing.
We're well aware of that stereotype.
It is a stereotype, isn't it?
Yeah.
So sorry, Stuart Lee, anyone else that you love to watch?
James Acaster.
Right. Yeah. Someone else talked about him. What is it about James Acaster that you like?
Again, just very funny, and I think he is he's very clever, and I think he finds comedy in places that not a lot of people would find it.
Right.
Or not a lot of people would look.
Yeah.
Like, just in, like, subtle sillinesses.
Yeah.
And likewise, a lot like us, finds it in sad stories.
Right.
He has a four-part book, like, 4 hours of comedy that all is about the worst year of his life.
Really?
His most recent 2-hour comedy special is about the worst year of his life, and the 4-part special is about him breaking up with his girlfriend, having a big identity crisis, but he veils that with these silly anecdotes about him pretending to be an undercover cop and all of that sort of stuff. And I think that's having sort of the contrast of the silliness with the quite crushing sadness of something like that. I think he's, as much as he probably wouldn't admit it, I think he is changing the way that people perceive comedy. And I think that...
Right.
Yeah, he, in becoming more mainstream, is sort of shifting comedy away from the whole, like, shock humour and going crazy type comedy. And more in terms of, building more personal stories that really hit close to home. That's what I...
Okay. What about you, Aaron? Do you have similar tastes to Finn, or?
I don't. Well, Finn's kind of got me listening to those two.
Yeah.
But my two are sort of Dylan Moran. People mostly probably know him in New Zealand if they watched Black Books a while ago.
Yeah. He's also in one of my favourite movies, Shaun of the Dead.
Yes. Yep. In Shaun of the Dead. Yeah. That's another one. Yeah. He plays a good role in that.
Yeah.
He's very observational.
Yeah.
Can make things very silly. Like, uses language really well.
Yeah.
Has
he got a persona? Like, I was wondering about personas. Like, do you guys, are you on stage, are you yourself, or are you a persona? You know, like...
Yeah, well, the thing about Dylan Moran, I hope I'm saying his name right, but he used to have that persona, like the drunken Irish philosopher, when he was probably, when he was 20s and 30s.
Yeah.
And now he's in, I think his 50s,
is he?
I think. Yep. where he's no longer that kind of character. So I'm watching him when he's no longer the drunken person.
Right.
So my influence isn't really as a kind of as drunken, maybe even kind of like he's not relying on that anymore.
Mm, mm.
So my stuff is, yeah, it's just very without that stuff. I guess without any extra props or anything or any kind of additional, I'm not sure what the right word is, but substance to help with the comedy.
Yeah, I see. Yeah.
So
you're just very funny.
And what about hecklers? That's the other thing I've been asking comedians about. Like, you know, your energy sort of strikes me as quite sort of, you know, you're not going out there to a, it's not insult comedy probably that your guys are doing. Mm. So when people give you shit, how do you deal?
Yeah, we were actually discussing this last night with the person who was at the show.
Yeah.
So it's we do get heckled every now and then.
Yeah.
We're quite odd comics to heckle because we're already in the ground and, you know, and in the grave. So it's very hard to...
It's hard to insult you? Is that what you're saying? Is it hard to say anything that can really...
Yeah. I don't know if you were to say something, the audience isn't going to be like, oh, that was, you know, they're probably going to turn against that person quite quickly. But
we don't really give people space to heckle us because we're already sort of heckling
ourselves. Oh, I see. Yeah, right.
But we're probably not going to have a go back at you.
Uh-huh.
We might. We might in our own way.
Yeah.
But we're probably not going to come back with a more Alexander Sparrow insult style.
Yeah.
It's just a way to do it. But I mean, last night there was people saying things and they were more like supportive heckles because I think we were like validating them, hopefully.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh yeah, that's true. And then even though it still disrupts the flow, but it's all part of the shows.
Yeah.
It's all part of the fun. Mm. Yes.
Yeah, I have a joke where I sort of go on quite a dark spiral, and then eventually it creates quite a large amount of tension in the crowd, and then eventually I break it afterwards. But I've had a couple times when I do that, I'll do the long monologue and then sort of stop for a bit, and I've had people call out like, "Are you okay?"
Oh, really?
In the crowd. And it's like
the ultimate supportive heckle.
Yeah, I appreciate it, but you really have ruined this punchline.
Oh, I see, really? They should have just sat with it for a bit longer.
Yeah, which might be on me. I might need to come in a bit quicker, but yeah, it's quite funny how we don't really get people being mean to us.
Have you ever had a nightmare? Like, tell us about a time when you've died on stage, or like, you know.
Well, that's the thing about our stuff is that, especially when we're trying to make something funny,
yeah.
Sad thing, and it's already, maybe it's not originally funny when we're working it out.
Mm.
That's the thing, is that you go through that first couple gigs telling the story, which might be 3 minutes long,
where
that audience is probably going to get a story that's a bit too raw.
Uh-huh.
And it doesn't have enough humor yet, and they're not comfortable enough yet.
Right.
So those, you know, I would say often... Every now and then when we're putting that new stuff out, that's when we might have...
So sort of testing new material, sort of, with an audience.
That's when we might have... I don't know if I've had a nightmare gig, but that's maybe when we might bomb a bit. And then we come back the second time and the third time.
Mm.
And by that time, the story's a bit lighter and then they're comfortable with it.
Right.
I don't know. Have you had a nightmare gig?
Not recently, I don't think. It's always when you're doing new material that you get a bit worried. But I think I feel as though I did have a gig recently where that was just comedians in the crowd. And I was trying some new material. That's always interesting.
Yeah. Are they a bit more of a savage audience? Are they a bit more...
Yeah. It depends. I mean, it depends on where you are and who they are. But more often than not, comedians are less likely to laugh at other comedians.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're a very poor gauge of whether or not something's funny.
I see, right, right.
Yeah,
okay.
Doing a big room with very few people, mostly comedians, not a lot of people laughing, that's a bit of a nightmare.
Okay. Have you ever been in a venue? I'm thinking of a story Gavin Hewitson told about. He got a free passage on the Bluebridge Ferry in return for doing a gig on the ferry. And he was in a room with his comedy partner was suddenly seasick, so he was on his own, and then... The people in there did not want to be entertained, you know, but he was told that's what he had to do. Have you ever been in that sort of environment where you felt like you're
competing with the rugby or something like that?
Actually, yes. So I was emceeing a gig, I think 2 weeks ago now, and I turned up. I didn't think I was emceeing.
Oh.
I think he just asked me to emcee at the time because he wasn't an MC, which right. was already like a bit of a stitch up. But yeah. you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And this is at a this is a gig in Wellington where the bar used to be a public bathroom, but and you're in a very small room. It's not even a room. It's more like a hallway.
Like a, you mean that's in a toilet? It used to be a
it's
toilet.
It's a glorified hallway, right. yeah. and the rugby's on up there.
Yeah.
So already you have to get people to somehow convince them to not watch rugby and watch you. Yeah.
Well, I think the gig was supposed to start at 8, but the rugby was supposed to finish at 9.
Oh. Yeah.
So we ended up pushing it back and back because I remember I was at that gig as well. Yeah. Luckily, it wasn't MC.
Yeah. And what happened? So the producer, he proceeded to get pretty drunk. I won't say any names, even though if you're in Wellington, you know exactly who this is. But and there was one part of the gig where someone was just kept going on. So they'd kept performing for a bit too long, maybe in the producer's head. But this guy was also pretty written off as well. And the producer is telling shining the light to get him off the stage. And it goes on for so long that the producer goes up on stage, takes the mic off him, puts it down. It makes quite a loud thump. And I'm in the back wondering what's going on because I have to come back out to this crowd.
Mm.
I come back out and start talking again. The crowd, none of the crowd's looking at me or the rugby. They're looking at these two guys, like wondering if they're like having a scuffle or something or some sort of confrontation. And so I'm like just dying out there. There's no way they want to listen to me and nor are they paying any attention to me. But the most ridiculous thing was is that the producer, who was really smashed, was the next person up.
Oh, God.
So... And so I'm just saying, are you still performing? And he's ignoring me.
Oh.
And he eventually, like 5 minutes later, just walks up onto the stage and just takes the mic off me. And then performs and bombs for another 10 minutes.
Oh, no.
So it's stuff like that where it's just, yeah.
So going on stage drunk is a really bad idea?
Well, I don't know. Sometimes I haven't done it myself, but...
Some people can do it.
Some people can do it.
Some people need to be drunk, maybe?
I would say some people are funnier drunk.
Oh.
But that's also a slippery slope.
Yeah.
Because if you can only tell jokes when you're drunk, then it's a bit of a worry.
That is not very sustainable for your career, maybe.
Yeah.
Golly. Okay, we better wrap this up. It's been great talking to you guys. Thanks for coming in. So your shows, are tonight at 6 p.m. Oh, sorry, last night it's Wednesday night, was last night. Mm-hmm. Your last show is tonight at 9 p.m. at Fringe After Dark.
That's the one.
$20 and $15, 1 hour. And, I'm hoping to catch you because I'm trying to work out if I can... Those buskers on the road sound quite amusing as well. Mm-hmm. They've got a cabaret at 10 o'clock tomorrow night, so I might catch them. You can buy the tickets online on Eventfinder if you go to the Whangarei Fringe page, whangareifringe.co.nz. And go to the What's On, and then click on the tile for Soy Boys. You can buy your tickets there, or on the door, but that might be a bit of a risk. I'm not sure the capacity of the Fringe After Dark. Is it about like...
I think it's about 100. So, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool. All right, well, thanks for coming in. Lovely to meet you, and good luck with the show tonight.
Likewise. Lovely to meet you too.
Thank you.
Cheers,
thank you.
Bye.
To the color of your dream. It is not leaving. It is not leaving. So play the game, existing to the end. Of the beginning. Of the beginning. Of the beginning.
I did not become someone different that I did not want to be. But I'm new here. Will you show me around? Meta Hapa Rong Dong. You can always turn around. Met a woman in a bar, told I was hard to get to know, nearby impossible to forget. Said I had an eagle on me, size of Texas. Well, I'm new here, and I forget. Does that mean big or small?
Welcome back to Fringe Radio. I'm having a great morning. Hope you enjoyed that conversation with the Soy Boys, Finn and Oren. It's always interesting talking to stand-up comedians and getting some ideas about what the show's about. And I'm pleased to welcome Adam. Is it Rohe? Is that the correct pronunciation?
Rohe. The Americanized. Yeah.
Oh, Rohe. Yeah. Okay. I was wondering if it's the Maori Rohe.
Yes. So do most folks. It's German. Rohe, I think is how you said it in German. But yeah, no, we immigrated to the States like a couple generations back, and that pronunciation took over.
I see. So, but it's spelt the same as the Maori word,
yep.
Rohe, isn't it? Which, okay. And Ben Sarton is also here. And Ben is part of the show. You're actually part of them. You're on stage with Adam?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
Cool.
I'm filming and I have a few lines.
I see. So you're actually filming during the show?
Yeah.
Oh. And is that in order to gather material for the documentary that you're making?
Yeah, that's part of it.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So I understand from your description, this has been in production for 6 years. Is that right?
Yeah, it must be close to seven.
I think it's seven now, yeah. Right. It was October, so yeah, it would be seven.
So how did you two sort of end up working together or doing this project together?
I used to work in a rock climbing room in Taranaki, and Adam used to come in climbing, and so we ended up just being climbing buddies for a bit.
Mm. Where was this? Which town?
This was in New Plymouth.
Uh-huh. Right. So you're both from New Plymouth?
I grew up in Tukurangi, which is just north of New Plymouth.
Uh-huh.
I'm not. I was born in the States, and then I grew up in the States in Cambodia, and then Stratford in Taranaki from when I was 11. Yeah.
So wait, the States, and then Cambodia, and then Taranaki. How did that little journey happen?
My parents and their social conscience.
Oh. what kind of work were they doing?
They're both medical professionals. They were working as physios, and my mum's a midwife as well.
Right.
They had both lived overseas previously, my dad with his first family and my mum as a child.
Right.
And they just wanted to get us kids out of the States before we got totally brainwashed into only one way of being.
Right.
Yeah,
wow.
So Cambodia was the answer.
And how long did you spend in Cambodia?
2.5 years.
Right. What's it like?
Different now than then. Then was pretty bleak, hot and dusty, and everyone had some sort of horror story and disability to prove it.
From the wars.
Yeah,
wars, there
was
the, right.
So the Vietnam War was in the early 70s, and that was fought. A lot of that was fought in Cambodia over the border, and then there was the Khmer Rouge after that, which is just kind of like big genocidal.
Yeah.
situation.
Yeah, nightmare. Yeah.
Yeah. So they were pretty fucked, and there weren't that many. Oh, can I swear on your show?
You're welcome to swear. We encourage swearing on this.
That's good.
Luckily, we don't have any advertisers to upset, so you can say what the fuck you like.
Okay, good. They were fucked. And there was like not that many white folks or aid organizations in yet. And still kind of two landmines going off a day at that time, and there were no other Barang or Pākehā kids in the city that we grew up in.
Really?
Yeah.
No so, other?
None.
So did you learn, how long, so you were there 2.5 years, was that long enough to learn the language or?
Yeah, we had it in a couple of months, my sister and I, just like small children's brains are quite very porous. Yes. Yeah.
Right, so how old were you again at that stage?
8.
Right, okay. So from Cambodia they came to New Zealand?
Yeah.
Oh, and they've settled here, I guess you're?
As settled as my family get.
Right.
Yeah.
So they're both, what, doctors? Oh, so your mum's a midwife.
And dad's a physio. Well, right. Dad's retired, but was a physio.
Oh, yeah. So they settled in Taranaki.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And that's how you bumped into Ben at the climbing wall in New Plymouth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So I guess you must have become friends then. You kind of got to know each other and...
Yeah, we hung out a couple of times, and then we sort of went our separate ways, uh-huh. as people do.
Yeah,
I was traveling around a bit, and I didn't even really know what you were up to. Theatre,
Studying
theatre.
Oh. Yeah, is that what you did? You study theatre, Adam?
Yeah, for 4 years I was in Palmerston North for a year, and then Auckland for 3 years.
Uh-huh.
You were, but I remember Ben because Ben had been cool in the rock wall and taught me how to ride a unicycle, and then I just kind of followed Ben on the socials.
Right.
Yeah, and I'd taken off to a few different disaster countries to do documentary filmmaking.
Uh-huh.
I went to Nepal after the earthquakes in 2016.
Uh-huh.
And Fiji after Cyclone Winston.
Right.
And a few of those other places, I'd like started to dig into documentary making.
Uh-huh.
And I think those sort the first couple of like just like really short docos that I made, just New Zealand based ones, I think was what got Adam interested in what I was doing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And then, yeah.
Yeah, and then it was 2015, I came out as trans, and I was in the business of storytelling and thought it should be a doco, whatever happens next.
Right.
And I still thought Ben was really cool, and I knew that he was making... Oh, sorry, they were making docos.
Mm.
And, yeah, so I called them up and was like, do you want to do something?
Mm.
Mm.
Great. So this is quite a... Did the other documentaries get made, Ben, like the Nepal and the Fiji ones?
Yeah, I was working for an NGO, and they were hiring me as a content creator, so I would take photographs and make really short, like sort of promotional documentary style content for them. So I made a lot of stuff for them.
It wasn't like a feature length documentary.
None of that.
Oh, okay. What's
social media things?
Right. What was the NGO, if you don't mind me asking?
I don't want to talk
about it. Okay, fine.
Yeah,
no problem.
They went all toxic and yuck.
Okay.
And I don't want them to have any promotion.
Okay, fine. Fair enough. So what's your background in terms of, are you self-taught as a documentary maker?
Yeah, mainly. Yeah, I just picked up a camera when I was doing a lot of unicycling, thought it was cool, and then just kept making movies.
So were you just a unicyclist, or were you a street performer, or like, what was the context of the unicycling?
I was like a... not street performing, not clowning. It was like competitive trials, unicycling and downhill, and a few other things. I competed in the World Champs.
There is a thing called competitive downhill unicycling.
Yeah, that's exactly what you imagine, like downhill tracks, but on unicycles.
Uh-huh.
And then trials like obstacle hopping over picnic tables.
So quite technically difficult.
Yeah.
And are you still a unicyclist?
Nah, I sold my unicycles. I kept hurting myself.
Oh, yeah. Is the injury thing quite a thing with unicycles? Is it quite likely to get injured? It looks quite unstable.
Not particularly, but when you just like, with anything, if you start to push further and further and harder and you get out to the like extremes of what your body can handle, then you're going to start hurting yourself. So same with skateboarding or motorcycling or whatever it is that you choose to do activity-wise, you end up, if you push hard enough, you start hurting yourself. So.
Okay, so this documentary, is there a kind of end point with this? Do you foresee there'll be a time when it's completed, or how do you sort of see that?
Yeah, there's three interviews left to do, and then it's shot.
Wow.
It's all shot. I mean, apart from the stuff we're doing, I'm shooting on stage, and that's partly for the documentary and just partly for ourselves to like have that record, because it's always nice to have a record of your shows that you do.
Yeah.
It demonstrates, having Ben and the camera on stage really demonstrate the role that having the camera in my life has played. So it's been like a quite consistent like point of reflection and processing for me for the last 7 years. So yeah, we're kind of demonstrating that as well by having Ben in the camera on stage.
And Ben's giving you access to the footage that's shot? Like, are you sort of reviewing it together and doing that as a sort of partnership?
Yeah, the way I sort of see it, and I'm not sure if you see it exactly the same, Adam, but I feel like we started this thing together having no idea really what we were doing with it. And then we got to a certain point and we thought a stage show would be a good idea, and I feel like Adam is doing a lot of the stage show driving.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like the show is Adam's interpretation of the story, but it is made with me. Like, we work together to make it, even though it's like Adam's version of the story. And I think that the film is going to be my version of the story, but Adam will help me with that as well. So it's not like I'm taking it off to do something alone with it.
Right.
It's a completely collaborative process the whole way through.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's been ongoing for the last 7 years.
Yeah.
Wow. Have you ever had, you know, has it been difficult? Has it been hard to sustain? Has it been, you know, tell me about that process, because it's quite a, that's quite a close long-term collaboration, I would imagine.
Mm. Well, there was a period of like quite rapid change early in the process when Ben and the camera were a lot more present in my world. And both of us were just like super broke and directionless, and like there were periods where Ben just moved into the spare room in our house and would just hang out.
Yeah.
And I mean, I would love to like give Ben the chance to talk about their decision making around when to film and when not to film, because I think that that's been quite a tricky thing for you to navigate. But then in terms of sustaining it, you know, with a transition, there's no end point to a person's transition. And so like the end, finding out what the end point to the story is has been difficult. But it hasn't been something that we've like had the same level of emphasis on catching footage for 7 years. It was a really concentrated point early on. And then I'll just ring Ben up and be like, this important thing's happening.
Right.
And it was always seen as like, I kind of saw it as an opportunity to go hang out with Adam, and I would just bring my camera along.
Right.
So
it was that sort of relationship. It wasn't sort of like a, it wasn't so formal. It sounds quite informal.
Definitely not formal.
Right. And yeah, that was probably helpful.
Yeah.
So what Adam said about you making calls about when to film and when not to film, would you like to say something about that?
Yeah, I think a lot of the time, again, it was sort of like agreed upon between the two of us, or if Adam had been going through something, I'd be like, hey, would you like to talk to the camera? Do you feel like you want to? And there was some like difficult times, some of which are in the show. Like the show's kind of focused around one particularly difficult stage of the process. And there was parts where I didn't bring my camera out because I didn't feel like I could. I felt like it was a private like moment that I didn't want to interrupt by saying, hey, can I pull my camera out and point it at this? And I didn't feel like it was, Adam was in a place where he could consent to that properly. And so there's definitely navigation around that, but it was always done as sensitively as I could.
And it sounds like it sounds like the relationship you've got, if something was filmed that was too sensitive or too difficult, Adam's input would be taken into account on that. You're not
completely
sort of one of those, because I guess as a documentary filmmaker, you know, you're trying to show something, and I guess often that for documentary filmmakers, that means you have to make some difficult calls about putting material in it that might be confronting for the person, the subject, but that's needed.
Yeah, I think there's an element of that is a bit toxic in documentary filmmaking. Like, I see it, and I think it, like, I mean, I don't know if I condone it or I don't, or I'm not really sure about it, but I definitely, it makes me uncomfortable to think of myself acting in that way of like going in and kind of like tricking people into showing me pieces of their lives and then using that to bolster my cred as a doco maker and to try and get some more views or clicks or ratings or whatever, awards or whatever it is now. So I don't really like the idea of kind of like that predatory documentary filmmaking.
Sort of sensationalizing feel about it. Like, but you know, I was watching a documentary recently on Netflix, and they've got to have something that like hooks you into the next thing. There's got to be some sort of reveal or some sort of, so will this be a the style of your documentary will be a full length documentary?
Yeah.
And so it's not like you're having to kind of have episodes. Was there a thought of making it episodic, or was it always going to be
We had lots of thoughts that we threw around at the start of it, and we were like, maybe it's just a short doco, maybe it's a series, maybe it's a web series, which web series can be like shorter and more rugged and a lot longer running. And then I think more recently I've settled on a feature. I don't really know exactly why I settled on a feature, but I think it just feels like I did some rough cuts, and it just feels like it's about the right shape to be a feature, the right size and shape for it.
So let's talk a bit about the show. Did you write the show, Adam? Like, did you write it as a sort of as a script, or did it kind of, was it devised, or how did it come together?
Yeah, I've worked with a few really wonderful collaborators in the script writing process. Like I said earlier, finding the end point of the story was really difficult, but so is, you know, if I'm just looking back at 7 years of my life, figuring out what the narrative is that I want to hook into and highlight has been really tricky. And my mind is one that gets yanked off course quite easily by interesting, shiny stuff. I've definitely needed help in distilling to its core what it is that I want to say at the show.
Right.
The collaborators that have been the most helpful with that are Ni Dekazraihana, who's a theatre maker, actor and director based in Wellington. Eve Gordon, who's like a long-term collaborator of mine and the creative director of the Dust Palace. Daniel Goodwin, who's another trans and queer poet who I've got a long friendship and collaborative artistic relationship with. So yeah, like three quite powerful, very emotionally intelligent and just like incredible artistic people have come in to support. But throughout the process, what I've been finding is the importance of like centering my authorship in this story. It's like, this is a story about me, and I need to tell it in the way that feels the most truthful for what I went through. So a script was developed there. It's all written down. Each night that I perform it, I learn something new. And so, and because it's just me, I'm able to tweak as I go along, which is cool. We've also had a bunch of run-ups at this show. So it was cancelled because of COVID at the end of last year. And the show that I would have made and performed then is totally different than the show that we made and performed this time.
When you say run-up, what do you mean? Like a postponement? Is that kind of...
Yeah, postponements. So it's been postponed significantly twice before our premiere season in Wellington.
Yeah. And that was at BATS?
Yeah.
And that was the first time you'd performed this. How long was your season there?
8 shows over 2 weeks.
Right. And how was that?
Amazing.
Really?
Yeah. It was. There were very significant people who came. Like, all of the key characters from the story at that time were in the audience at some point, which was really important.
Right.
And
so how do you portray them in the show?
Well, we've got footage of them.
Uh-huh.
So they're literally shown.
Uh-huh, right. So there's a screen with... material
This is important context.
The
show look like, Ben?
So the show looks like lots of it is Adam telling a important story, and then supplementing that story with video footage, being like, there's this, you know, here's a thing, I'm going to also illustrate it on the screen or help the screen like build the story more to give more context, to like fill the thing out a little bit more, so it's not just Adam sitting there talking the whole time.
So you'll stop at that point, Adam, and allow the image to tell, to kind of take over?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, right. So I'll introduce the content and then we'll watch it on the screen. And one thing that Eve said, which I really like about what that brings, is that she said that there's more time on stage than you get in a typical theatre show, because we're watching, like, me from 7 years ago processing things and then me now talking about those things.
Yeah.
And so... in like a really tangible way, we've got 7 years of a person's life on stage. And we can, like, you know, I'm contrasting the way that I think now with the way that I thought then, and how I understand myself now with how I understood myself then.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen that format before. It's quite an interesting way to present it. Are there other examples of that you'd seen, or did it kind of just evolve as a way of making the show? Like,
not that I'd seen.
Yeah.
Not really.
It's kind of like live... I think you use the phrase live documentary, maybe, do you?
Yeah.
This live show combines storytelling and documentary, so...
Yeah.
I saw a film made with the Beastie Boys, and it was essentially... The Beastie Boys thing was kind of similar, but a lot more extravagant, and sort of like a really fancy TED Talk with the some video in the background complimenting what they were saying. So sort of a similar format to that.
Yeah, but they don't use, like, you know, theatre and metaphor in the same ways.
Yeah.
And was you, as your will you consider you're a performer in the show, Ben? How do you describe your role?
I have some lines and I mostly lurk in the shadows.
Right. Yeah,
but I'm always there.
So there's no sort of dialogue between the two of you? And
there's a tiny little bit.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But I feel like we kind of like did that, like Adam said, to almost replicate what it was like going through that process, because that was kind of my role. I was like sort of there, would show up quietly.
Mm.
Every now and then would be kind of noticeable. Every now and then I'd say a few things.
Mm.
Just the quiet observation of the thing. So I'm just acting out the quiet observation that I have done over the last 7 years.
Right.
I think.
Yeah.
Okay, so the show's an hour long.
70 minutes.
70 minutes, right, okay. So you said you did an eight show season at Bats.
Mm-hmm.
And has it evolved significantly since then, or is it essentially the same? Or
a bit. So Bats, the season was 85 minutes in total, so we've had to snip 15 minutes, and in that length of a program, that's quite a significant chunk of time.
Mm.
So what's coming now is, I think it's a lot cleaner actually than what we had in Wellington.
Mm.
It feels more tight.
Mm.
It's essentially the same. It's just been like, had a good pruning.
Mm. Well, I'm curious to know about, you know, having this conversation about being trans and transitioning and stuff like that. Does it, I'm guessing, you know, the transition is a physical transition as well as a sort of transition of your identity. And is that part of the... Is that part of talking about that? Because that's quite a personal thing. Is it a difficult sort of thing to talk about like that?
This is a really important question. Give me a second.
Okay.
There are a lot of trans people who have shared their stories of transition with the world.
Mm.
And we're getting a bit sick of it as a community, because what it means is that the world fixates on the transition, in particular, the like visible elements of a person's transition as the identifying features of that person.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, whoa, the interesting thing about you is that you have a beard now and you didn't before, you know, or you've had all these surgeries.
Mm.
And so, I was very wary of making another transition story.
Mm.
It takes place over the course of my gender transition, in particular in the early days. Mm-hmm. And so that is inevitably present in the story and has like quite a significant presence.
Mm.
But what I'm trying to talk about is what it felt like taking on the job of figuring out who I am for myself and then figuring out how to share that with others. So it's not about the transition, it's about me being like, wait a second, hang on, everyone's told me all these things about myself, do I agree? If not, then what do I even think?
So
that's what the story's about.
So has it been, I hesitate to use the word therapeutic for you, but having this sort of opportunity to reflect and to put into words and sort of concretely think it through and to present it as a show and as presented as a documentary, has that been a good...
Incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't tell you how healing and insightful it's been for me. There were so many skeletons in the closet, particularly from those early days where I just really derailed myself, and the things that I was going through had massive impact on the lives of people that I care about that had haunted me for a long time and I hadn't been able to face. And so the necessity of facing those things in the context of this story, with the like central kaupapa being, center myself and forgive myself and celebrate myself, has just been so profound in the way that I hold not just me back then, but then also the way that I do relationships now and the just like how I'm navigating my life. Yeah, it's been really, really helpful to do it. The documentary was originally my idea and so was the show. They're both things that I felt I needed, and I'm getting the things that I hoped I would by doing them.
Wow. That's awesome. What about the title Man Lessons? I'm kind of, what's that? Because there's a sort of playfulness about that, which I don't know if that's intentional, but...
Yeah, it is. Okay, when I came out as a dude, it made a lot of the types of people that I... It was 7 years ago, right? We're at a different place now with the conversation around trans folk than we were then. Yeah. I was very new, and most of the people that I'd met had never met a trans person before. Mm. And I hung out with a lot of dudes. I worked as a tradie.
Really?
Yeah. And they didn't know how to deal with me at all.
Right.
And the bros had this bit. Like, it was a really familiar bit. And it came at me from lots of different angles and lots of different people. But the bit went like this. Oh, mate, You want to, okay, you want to be a man? Well, let me show you how to do something.
Open a beer on anything.
Yeah.
Oh, right, that was a significant man lesson.
Yes, no. The one that is most crystallized in my mind was there were two builders, Big Brad and Little Brad, and Little Brad taught me how to open a beer with a plank of wood as a way of, like, inducting me into manhood and teaching me how to be a man.
Right. I mean, it sounds like you put yourself in an environment where masculinity is quite defined and possibly quite narrow.
Mm. I wasn't in that environment for very long.
Right.
Yeah, I bailed and then just, like, went full-time in the arts after that.
All right. Was that a bit masochistic, becoming a tradie as a trans person? I mean, not masochistic, but, like, what was your real intention to become a tradesperson?
I was working as a painter throughout my uni holidays before I realized I was trans. And it was just way better money and hours than my mates who were working in hospo.
Oh,
yeah.
Right. Yeah. Fair enough.
Then I came out as trans and it fucked it all up and I left.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So man lessons, does that make it into the show? The kind of the idea that, you know, there are some codified ways of being a male, which, you know, you could look at and go, because I guess we were talking about this with the soy boys and I was like, well, where does the soy boys thing come from? And they said in the States, a soy boy is a sort of a put down by the sort of right, the alt-right, to indicate a lack of masculinity, you know, you're a soy boy, and I guess that's not really familiar to us here. And, you know, on the spectrum of masculinity, we were sort of saying, you know, there's sort of alpha male at one end and gay at the other end, and then what is there in the middle? Maybe metrosexual, or, you know, so it's not a very broad spectrum in terms of ways of being. So the man lessons, is that into the show? Is that kind of concept woven into the show?
I want to talk about this one.
Here you go.
I think that the title Man Lessons is kind of like a little bit... what's the right word for it? It's meant to, like, kind of like annoy people in the back of their head a little bit.
Yeah, definitely.
Whereas, like, I can imagine people who consider themselves very, very manly being like, oh, what kind of fucking lessons are these going to be?
Uh-huh.
And I'll go have a look and have... And then they might actually learn something about accepting themselves.
Yeah, interesting.
Which would be amazing. And also, there's definitely... I feel like there'll be people who... maybe kind of feel like man space, like... there's a lot of male-dominated spaces, and they kind of get annoyed with that, and they may want to show up to, like, get a bit more ammunition and be like, this is crap, and, like, bag on it. And hopefully, again, those people, like, the people who are triggered and a little bit annoyed by the name are the kind of people that I think would really get a whole lot out of the story.
Right. So you'd welcome them to the show.
Definitely.
You're not expecting a fully necessarily, you know, preaching to the converted, you know, totally on board with trans people, you know. I'm sure those people are at your show. I guess that it's quite an important thing for them to see it as well.
Yeah, a bunch come. And I had some, like, in Wellington, we had some people who had family members who were trans and they hadn't been very exposed to these kinds of narratives before, and they got a lot out of it. And then trans people come and they're like, oh, because I'm offering insight into the, like, the existential crises that dominate at that time. A lot of trans folk who came found it quite confronting or beautiful or felt seen in a new way. So it's great if they come, but it's not just for them. I think that, for me, the title, we toyed early on with a lot of... I thought the show was going to be way funnier and gaggier than it has turned out. Mm-hmm. And so we had a lot of ideas about, like, what are these kind of tongue-in-cheek lessons that I learned that did not make it into the final version of the show.
Yeah.
But I remember at the time when I was being taught these lessons by the men that I was around, in the back of my head I was like, yes, I've got a high voice and these fat lumps on my chest and I've been socialized a certain way and I, every now and then we'll put on a dress and, you know, I've, like, got this way of being. But I'm a man, therefore this is a way that one can be a man. So would you like some lessons as well? And I think now this is my, like, this is the lessons that I wish that I'd been able to offer those dudes in manhood. You know, like, you can have a breakdown. You can have feelings and confusion and be vulnerable. We all need, you know, like, all of those... dismantle that bullshit toxic masculinity lessons.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, they're making it out now.
Awesome. All right, well, we need to wrap this up because we're about to run out of time. Cool. And it's been really great meeting you and talking to you, Ben and Adam. Thanks so much for coming in. It's been really enjoyable talking to you. I'm hoping to catch Barrier Ninja, which I think is starting right now here at 113.